This episode of We Are Libertarians is brought to you by Audible.com. Enjoy one free audiobook courtesy of We Are Libertarians. Choose from more than 100,000 audiobook titles, including works by Ron Paul, Walter Block, Murray Rothbard, and the Cato Institute. Audible.com also has audio of radio and TV programs and audio versions of magazines and newspapers. You can get the Audible app on any mobile device or download the audio to your computer. Go to audibletrial.com/WAL or head to WeAreLibertarians.com and find the link to get one free month of Audible today. All right. Welcome to We Are Libertarians for this week. I'm Chris Spangle, your host. To my right is Greg Lenz.
How are you, buddy?
I'm doing great. And then across the table from me is Brett Bittner from the Advocates for Self-Government.
Yes, sir. Having a great time.
And you are a man of many hats. You're also on the Central Committee for the State Libertarian Party of Indiana.
Yes.
The Marion County Board.
Yes.
For the Libertarian Party of Marion County, you are on the National Libertarian Committee as an alternate.
That's correct.
You are the executive director of the Advocates for Self-Government, or
yes,
as I lovingly refer to them as the quiz people, which you
we'll take it.
Yeah. So if you've ever taken the world's smallest political quiz, you've taken it out of Brett's hands.
It's
so
true.
Yeah.
It's true. Especially if it's been in the last 2 years, it's been out of my hands almost directly.
He is Johnny Liberty Seed. He is spreading liberty all over the place. And what else? You've been an elected libertarian.
Yes, you were two terms.
Appointed and then reelected to the school board of Marietta, Georgia.
Yeah, I was appointed on the Marietta Historic Preservation Commission and the Historic Board of Review. And that led to me finding out who the movers and shakers were in Marietta city government.
Mm-hmm.
Shortly after serving on those two boards, I was asked to run when an opening came up on the Marietta City School Board. We had a person leave early, so there was a special election. I won that special election. And the very next year, I was running again.
Right.
And won re-election shortly before moving here to Indiana.
Very good. Sorry, I was drinking my ginger beer.
Ah, yes. Everybody, Spangle is getting sloshed tonight on ginger beer.
White girl wasted.
I've had a hard day, okay? My 20-year-old girlfriend's telling her mom that she's dating a 32-year-old as we speak. I needed to take the edge off.
Are you going to be getting like text updates while this goes on?
Yes. So it'll be like the episode where my wife left me.
Except hopefully better.
Sorry, it's a joke.
Actually, is that true? Because she never did come back. So
no,
that's really the best thing ever.
Literally, for you new listeners, if you go back and listen to the late February episode of We Are Libertarians, where it's Gina and Greg and I.
Last year, 2014.
2014. And it's late February. And you hear me talk and talk and talk, and then I just go silent. And that is because my wife came home and started packing up her things and never came back. Did I mention I'm dating a 20-year-old? I'm okay with it now.
The real question is, does she know?
Yeah, no. No.
I feel like that's, you know, a private Facebook message is the best way to let her know.
Emily is aware that we are dating. She's...
No, I'm talking about your ex-wife.
Oh, yeah, no. She definitely knows we're not dating. So she makes it clear that we are never to speak again.
No, I meant, does she know you're dating a 20-year-old?
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah. I want to send her a photograph of every girl
I've
dated.
Hope you found happiness.
You're gonna do this right.
Clearly, I have.
Yeah, like literally.
Best wishes.
Oh, Greg, if I sent her a picture of, then, oh my God, forget it. It'd be over. Yeah, that was a good one.
Well, you're going to, you know how I have very distinct feelings about that individual, so I'm not going to say anything positive.
Or if I sent her a picture of Christine, you might have heard that one. So, I'm just saying, listen, I took the high road then. It's 2 years. The statute of limitations is up. I don't have to take the high road anymore, goddammit.
No.
She treated me like a bag of shit, okay? So... I'm not bitter, all right. I'm very
happy. It's been a long week at work. We just touched on some emotional things.
I know. It's almost
so Liberty.
Right.
Liberty and our new guest.
And, yeah.
Our new contributor.
So I got to follow that.
Yeah, you got to talk right into the mic. Okay. You got to like treat that mic like it's a like you're gay. So,
hold on, let me show you a picture.
Yeah, that picture of Bernie Sanders.
I sent it I sent it to you.
Oh, great.
There you go.
Yeah.
It's his new campaign.
Bernie Sanders is a cuckold.
Perfect.
That is quite a photo. Where did you find that gem?
This one.
Sorry.
Whoa.
All right. My bad.
Wow.
It's the gingerbread man.
Apparently. He's growing stronger. that's from 4chan.
I got to get a new mic cover. I just threw up all over the microphone. Yeah.
Anyway, to our new guest and contributor.
Chris Mayo.
Yeah. This is going great.
Yeah.
Yep. This is how I felt last week.
Share this with your friends and family. I know.
I can't wait to put this on Facebook.
Yeah. Hi, Mom.
Let's make sure
your two young children listen,
right,
too.
Renee, this is why I wasn't home Thursday night.
We're talking about cuckolds and Chris Spangle's ex-wife.
If you just skip to 20 minutes in, you'll start hearing about Liberty.
Yeah. If you get past him calling his ex-wife a bitch and his vindictive. So, anyways, Chris Mayo, you are the current chair of the Libertarian Marion of Marion County, right?
That is correct.
And what else? What else do you do?
Well, I
CrossFit, right? I see the photos.
I wad.
Let me guess.
There are three things that everybody knows about people if they're CrossFitters, if they're vegan, or if they're an atheist. You know,
right?
Yeah, pretty much. I work out at the airport. I've been in aviation for a long time since I got out of the Air Force. Wife, two kids. We homeschool. You know, as far as outside libertarian stuff, I guess that's the main thing I do. I don't wear a whole lot of hats like Brett does.
How long have you been a part of the Libertarian Party of Indiana?
About 3 years.
Okay. Yeah. Longer than I thought.
I've literally never had a conversation with Chris Mayo.
No.
So
really?
I've been gone that long.
We've crossed paths and stuff, but yeah, no.
And his tenure in the Libertarian Party of Indiana is longer than mine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like how he plays it, though. Yeah. He doesn't overcommit.
When I quit something, I quit.
Yeah, you just were like, you dropped mic and exited stage left.
Screw you guys.
It's like marriage.
Home. Like, I've had just about enough of you libertarians. I'm voting for Pence just to watch you cry.
Well, that almost happened.
Oh, sore subject.
Oh, man.
I don't know.
Huh? What? Who are we talking about? What are we talking about?
I have no idea.
Yeah, we don't know what we're talking about either.
Oh.
All right.
But so you are the chairman of the Marion County Libertarian Party here in Indiana.
That's correct.
And then a big reason we wanted to have him on is you are... please excuse. He's drunk already after one ginger beer.
Cut him off.
Oh, my God. I can honestly say I've never seen him like this. This is a first.
I'm in a really good mood.
Did you get wasted at work?
Well, not in a manner of speaking, yes, but not drunk.
All right. Anyway.
No, it's my new Adderall addiction. I can't help it. That's a joke.
Yeah, I'm kidding.
I can't do drugs or drink. Like, literally, I took a half a Valium a year and a half ago, and then the next day I took the other half, and I was high for approximately 4.5 minutes because I was like 300 pounds then.
Every time I hear this story, the time gets shorter and shorter that he was high.
Just because you don't know how to tell the story doesn't mean you can make fun of those who do. I have thought about Adderall or a Valium literally every day since that took place. That's why I don't drink, because I would really be really good at drinking and really bad at life.
Yeah, that's smart. That's good.
So I'd be living in my mom's basement again.
It'd be a very libertarian thing.
Right, like, yeah, exactly. Right.
Well, that, and then, like, you know, that's the epitome of the libertarian message to an extent is
more.
The self-control to not need government laws to tell you how to live.
So, Chris Mayo, welcome. Thank you for joining us. You homeschool your kids, so we're going to talk about homeschooling, which in, like, 140 episodes we've never talked about.
Well, to clear it up, I don't. My wife does.
Right. Yeah. Well, we all know the wives do all the work. Right.
I just take the credit for how well they turn out.
Right. Yeah. So trust me, we're aware. We have a married friend. His name's Joe Ruiz. We know Mickey does everything. So.
Somebody take the bottle away from him.
I know.
No shit.
All right. Let's start out, you know, I mean.
Well, Brett, what is your connection to homeschooling? Because I was under the impression you were, like, for a period, but no?
Yes. There is a period of time where the schools that were available did not meet my educational needs, and in the fourth grade, I was homeschooled.
You were homeschooled for just the 1 year?
Just the 1 year.
Nerd!
Yes, and then we found a school that actually did meet my educational needs the next year.
And now, was that a public school?
It was not. It was a private Christian school, and they had a program that allowed me to move at my own pace. And so I
what kind
covered.
Of shoes did you wear?
God damn it!
Unreal.
Did you get the white shoes, black shoes. Did you ride a short bus?
Is this a first for you too?
What?
Yeah. Like I honestly think you might be drunk. Or like he'd.
Wow.
I'm like a little stunned.
I know it's.
We spent a lot of time together. A lot of like we've witnessed some funny things, like Chris Galton Creighton's fight over Google Chat versus Facebook Chat, and I still don't think I've ever seen you this tickled. Like you are giddy and you're crying, you're
I'm
weeping,
literally crying. I saw a little Brett Bittner with his bowl cut. He's walking into a special school. He's got his little backpack on, and he's moving at his own pace. It's so cute.
I'm sure that it was.
Mom standing.
Mom said it was.
Crying.
Yeah. I think we ought to add cyberbullying to this.
Jeez.
Actually, he's doing it to your face.
I know.
Podcast bullying.
Podcast bullying. For everybody to hear.
I know. Brett's sitting here opening up, telling us about his experience and how he
telling
overcame
you
a public school system.
Elementary school.
Yeah. And the only thing you care about is whether his bus was short and he had on pedo shoes with two straps.
I mean, they're Velcro, but you're right. They're Velcro.
Way to go.
Did you have a flat top or a bowl cut? I know you had hair then.
Actually, I think it was closer to a mullet at the time.
Yes.
It was short and spiky on top, and it was long and curl in the back. And
so you had
it's okay, you didn't know any better.
Wow.
Oh, man.
Well, don't you wish you'd have been homeschooled now?
Yes.
Right?
Yes, I do.
Jeez. He'd have been pushing you in a locker.
The problem with homeschool kids is they have no social skills.
None. None whatsoever.
Yeah, absolutely none.
Yeah.
On.
Are you decent?
Good.
Are you sure?
I'm afraid.
Can I continue opening up about my experience in the Christian school?
Moving on.
They'll let me move at my own pace.
I want you to just calm yourself for a minute and think about the moment you proposed to your first wife.
So, Brett, tell us more about your school.
So, it was a program that allowed us to move at our own pace. Not worrying about grade levels, not worrying about what we should be learning at that time. It was grasping the concepts that we weren't ready to handle academically. So,
and was this a like? Was this like a state funded program?
No, this was a private school.
So it's a private school, and so had to pay to go. I'm sure.
Yep. It's very similar to the Carpe Diem model.
Okay.
The charter school system here in Indiana and in Arizona, and I believe they're opening a campus or two in Georgia over the next few years. But what it does is it allows you to interact with. In my classroom. There were fourth graders to eighth graders, and there were 15 of us, and we had one teacher. But we all moved at our own pace. It didn't matter if you were sixth grade level reading and 18. ninth grade level science. You were actually learning the things that you were ready to learn.
Okay.
And
so this was fifth grade then?
Fifth and sixth grade.
So this would have been like early 90s.
Yeah.
Which would have been way ahead of the curve for any of this stuff.
Right.
Because homeschooling didn't really even uptick in popularity till late 90s.
When I was homeschooled.
Oh, sorry.
It was very weird. People didn't understand why I wasn't in school. They didn't understand why We were doing things very differently. And
I'm sure. Yeah, the social aspect of like your buddies saying, you know, how's your new school? Or
exactly.
You know, was it a different? Did you change neighborhoods or move while this went on?
I don't remember. We moved around a lot when I was young, but it was an opportunity for me to experience different things. And I have to say that the thing that was probably most the biggest positive experience. And I know that for a lot of the homeschoolers that I know, this is a positive for them as well. But because it was a classroom with 4th through 8th graders, we were able to interact with people.
You weren't just confined to your age group.
Right. It wasn't.
Yeah. Oh, nobody laughed.
The people that were born in the same 12-month period in the same zip code.
Right.
Because we all had different needs. We all had different educational needs. And
so it still was community-based then. It wasn't just completely.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. We had group projects that we worked on. We had a lot of free time once you finished your goals for the day and things like that. In fact, when I was on the school board in Marietta, we adopted a pilot program for 50 7th and 8th graders to do something very similar, although it was a lot fancier than what we did with workbooks and things like that when I was in this particular program. You know, a lot of it is computer-based and now a lot along the lines of what Carpe Diem does, but it was a very positive experience for me, because then the rest of my school career was super easy,
right?
Because I'd already covered almost everything by the time I was done with 6th grade.
And like, do you think that process too? Because this is something I always tell like even my nephew and stuff is that it's, you know, it's not so much. The school, the real goal of the teacher is to teach you how to learn and to become like what they call like an autodidact, like a self-learner.
Right.
And like that seems to be it. Like once you grasp that, you were able to scale it up and then go as far up the curve as you needed
exactly.
to.
Although it did make the next 6 years of school very boring.
So I was going to ask. So you went back to a public school after that, right?
Yeah, I did. We couldn't afford the private school anymore. Mm-hmm. So then I went to public middle school for 7th and 8th grade. And that was very boring. I think that if I hadn't been so involved with extracurricular activities, I probably wouldn't have excelled.
Sure.
I would have just turned everything off and said, screw it, I'm done. I do wish, though, that I had taken the advice that I was given probably around the end of middle school, and that was just to get my GED and move on. Mm-hmm. Although I do feel like I got a lot out of my high school experience. Unfortunately, none of it was in the classroom.
Yeah, sure. I can see that.
Yeah.
Very little. I'll rephrase. Very little of it happened in the classroom.
Right.
You know, I always felt like I took some AP level stuff sophomore year, and it wasn't so much that I felt like I learned. I mean, I definitely went further into topics and learned more, but it wasn't like so much more other than I felt that it was just heaping on busy work in preparation for college for the workload, not for the amount of knowledge.
It was a lot of teaching to the test, even back in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Right, because, you know, like the AP credits, how many you have going in and that kind of stuff is so, you know, that's, they get funding for that based on, like, you know, how many of your kids graduate that get AP credits.
I don't remember that being a part of the funding formula in Georgia. I don't know if it
is in Indiana. What was it, like Carmel had Latin and stuff and you had to maintain. Like, you can add extra higher-end courses if you maintain a certain level of AP advancement.
Yeah, I know that they offered smaller class size for the AP classes, and especially if you were excelling in terms of the results. And I remember that back then and during my time on the school board.
Okay. And then, Chris, obviously, since, you know, this was something I really wanted to discuss, you know, I kind of threw at you,
right?
But you know, you are, I don't really have anyone in my, you know, that it's like a peer like you that like is homeschooling their children right now.
Well, and it's kind of funny, actually. I was public schooled my entire life, and I actually went to a lot of different schools here around Indianapolis. I went to IPS schools for a while, and then I ended up graduating from New Palestine.
Okay.
My wife went to some public schools, and then she spent her high school career in at Cecina.
Oh, wow.
Which she pretty much paid her way through that herself and worked.
That's a local Catholic school in Indianapolis.
Yeah, it's actually right around the corner from where I live.
Exactly. Yeah. She knows the area.
Yeah.
But so it was before she was even pregnant, and we were already talking about having kids. And I told her that I wanted to homeschool our kids. And she absolutely, no way. I mean, what's the first thing you think of when you think about homeschooling kids?
What is it?
Socialization, you know. You're thinking, oh, how are they going to socialize with other kids.
How's little Brett going to be treated while he's learning at his own pace?
With his Kentucky waterfall.
Unfortunately, that's probably the first thing she thought of.
Well, and you know, I think that's interesting. I'm good friends with the Libertarian Homeschooler. If you guys are on Facebook and know her, and I know that you and your wife, you and your wife are big fans. But I know her in real life. Mm-hmm. I know both the young statesman and the baby anarchist. Sorry, it's hard for me to remember what their names are there because I think of them by their actual names. But I know those two. One young man and one almost young man, and they are probably some of the best socialized kids I've ever met, because not only are they not exposed to the bullying, the drugs, the behavior problems, teaching to the test, and all of the problems that happen in taxpayer funded education,
like the stigma of, you know, not knowing something and speaking up,
right?
You know, just trying to coast through, and you see that time and time again with millennials. They're so afraid to be wrong, they'll never even put forward something that is wrong.
Yeah. But it's not even so much among peers, because the young statesman who's 15 now, he interacts well with younger kids. He interacts well with adults. He interacts well with older adults. And he has a very vast array of friends and peers, because he's not limited to the 12-month period in the same zip code that he was, because he has very different educational needs. And if you've been following the page, you'll know that he's taken a path towards musicianship, and that's going to expose
towards him. What? Sorry.
Musicianship.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He plays the organ for church. He works a lot on choral directing. He was part of the Georgia Boys Choir. His younger brother is also part of the Georgia Boys Choir. And so they have a lot of interaction with people that aren't their own age, which I think is a more well-rounded way to look at socialization, because you take a look at what happens when you get out into the real world. It isn't people that are the same age as you. In my office right now, we have one person who's 13 years younger than me. We have one person who is 20 years older than me, and one that's almost 30 years older than me. And so those aren't people that are the people that I grew up with.
No.
They aren't people who are 36 years old like I am. There's a wide array, and you have to be able to be successful, you have to be able to interact with people of different ages. And so I think that homeschooling actually gives you that opportunity, because you're using various resources, because you're looking for experts in the areas that they are. It's not like, I believe the way that it's been personified, where they're all wearing the Little House on the Prairie dresses, and they all sit around they all sit around with their mom doing schoolwork all the time. They're actually going out, and they are working to meet their educational needs and go on the path that they're on. And for somebody to be 15, I think that the young statesman is somebody who has chosen his path. He's made a commitment to it, and they're doing everything that they can to support that.
Yeah, there's no social aspect of whether or not, like, he should go into that. Like, if you were in a class, it'd be, you know, don't play the organ.
Right.
You know, play football.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Learn music theory, you know, and he's done a lot in that way, and there isn't a focus on, you know, what's going to happen on Friday night.
Right.
Are you going to, you know, when I lived in Marietta, I offered to take both boys and Anna and Don to a football game, and the young statesman wasn't interested.
Mm-hmm. Right?
It was something that, you know, it didn't mean anything to him, and the baby anarchist, he's not really interested in sports either. I mean, I know that he's done some athletic activity, but it's not a organized team sport.
And what was this website again?
It's the Libertarian Homeschooler. It's just a page on Facebook.
Okay.
And she's actually a writer for The Advocates. We publish what we call Conversations with My Boys, which are conversations that she has with the young statesman and the baby anarchist about ideas of liberty. We go into the things that they talk about in the real world. They talk about interaction with other people, but they are really profound conversations that you don't, and you see a lot of thoughts coming from a 10 and a 15-year-old, and I've been following the page for a couple of years, so I have to keep reminding myself how old they are. Yeah,
they've grown.
They have grown quite a bit. In fact, the first time I met Anna, who is the Libertarian Homeschooler and the Young Statesman, I served on a panel 3 years ago, 2 years ago now? 3 years ago now, and that was when I first met them. And just seeing how well-spoken he was, how much he was able to engage on a panel with three adult men of varying ages. He held his own at the time he was 12. And, you know, he's an exceptional young man, and I think that there's so much that can be learned from the way that they're doing things. But they had that conversation before the kids were born, in fact, before they were married. About what was going to happen, that they wanted to homeschool the kids. Well,
yeah, that's what's curious to me, because you were public school, she's private school.
Right.
And then you, though, had very sincere thoughts about this.
I did. And
where did those kind of come from?
Well, this was probably, my son was born in late 2007, so this was around 2005, 2006. And I grew up in a really Republican household, Republican family. I mean, my grandfather, Rush Limbaugh, was a religion. You know, and it was around that time I was in the military. I was in Iraq and Afghanistan all the time. There was a lot of things going on in politics with the Iraq War and
John Kerry.
John Kerry, and then you know you started to see kind of the rise of Ron Paul, and so that's kind of when I got an understanding of what libertarianism was. It was more philosophical. I didn't have anything to do with the party at the time. But I kind of realized that's where I fit.
He regrets every second.
Maybe I'm better off. I don't know.
So you're in. Were you over there when it really became your political philosophy?
I was. Yeah. I hate putting it this way, but I literally spent, you know, days at a time, you know, hauling flag draped coffins or kids with missing limbs or refugees. I mean, and all this stuff. So it kind of. It sinks in. You really, I mean, when you're sitting on an airplane for 18 hours looking at a coffin, you know, you really start thinking about stuff.
Why?
And you got a lot of time to do reading. So it was kind of more of a philosophical thing at the time. You know, it was one of those things. I want to raise my kids and opt out of the
propaganda
state system. Exactly. And you brought up a good point, actually. One of my arguments all along is I'm 34. And I have never been interviewed for a job by anybody that was my age or younger, or anybody in that 12-month bracket. It was always
51, 48.
I guess my boss is probably about 15, 16 years older than I am right now. And it's having that interaction with people that are in all these different groups. And I mean, my son, and I'll get into more of what they do later, but I mean, he can sit down and have a conversation with an adult better than most 8-year-olds that I know.
Keep eye contact.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
He can. He's very engaging.
I can tell you. Go ahead. Once you finish your thought.
Well, and I was just going to say, we were at a graduation party for a public high school student a couple years ago, and one of his family members was there with her daughter, and she was a freshman at IU. She was homeschooled her whole life. And while you know the kids were in there being kids, I say kids, they were 18, they graduated high school, they were in another room. She was in there having a conversation with us like I couldn't believe.
Yeah.
I mean, it was incredible. She was 19 years old. She had no problem getting into Indiana University at all whatsoever. It was incredible. And I mean, to hear her talk, it's like if I was hiring somebody, I would have hired her right there.
Yeah, for your first pick every time.
Exactly, yeah. But I'm sorry, somebody asked.
Yeah. I think part of the confidence that may come from homeschooling, I mean, I was traumatized several times as a kid, and I'm sure every libertarian listening to the show will identify with this. You know, being the third grader, sitting on the sidelines, not being able to be part of the cool crowd, you know, being told you're too fat to play on the team. I mean, constant harassment until ninth grade. You know, the reason that I tried to be funny and the reason that I work for a comedy show and I'm so into comedy is that I had zero friends in seventh and eighth grade. Zero. And I figured out in eighth grade at one point that if I told people jokes, they would talk to me. So by ninth grade, I had a joke of the day, and like girls were coming up and asking the joke of the day and talking to me. Like, you know, that's when I became a popular person by the end of 12th grade, because I learned how to socialize myself. You know, they just throw you into the public school and say, here, figure it all out. You know, meanwhile, you're going through emotional trauma. And I'm not trying to sound like a whiner. I think people have scars from the socialization process of school that they never really sit and think about mm-hmm. in depth. And
a lot block them out.
Yeah. And
you know,
so
they try, or attempt to. And
I still, to this day, when I walk into a room of peers or any social situation where there is an established group of people, I think that I don't deserve to be there, and I desperately want that group's acceptance. And that directly stems from the socialization process of elementary school.
Yes.
And that is an erosion of my self-confidence and my ability to connect with people because I am feeling insecure. And that is a direct result of actually a friend that we've talked about, Brad.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can remember times where this one kid who I thought was the most popular kid in the grade really put me down, excluded me. Like that one person, he wasn't bullying me. He didn't know what he was doing. He was like 8. You know, you don't think about that kind of stuff when you're going through it or when you're fighting for your own social standing. It's literally Lord of the Flies. And that has to this day affected my confidence levels and my attention seeking behavior. i.e. I have my own podcast, and I work in entertainment, is a direct result of that. So it worked out. I made it work for me.
If it makes you feel any better, I shot this individual in the face with a BB gun.
There you go.
I didn't know it was retribution for Spangle, but like that kind of set the power dynamic forever once it was a point-blank shot in the face.
I was in love with this girl. Her name is Jamie. And the individual that we're talking about is Brad. Good dude. I hold no ill will whatsoever. But at the time, I did, certainly. We were on baseball teams. My dad and his dad fought. It was all bunch of bullshit. But I was so in love with Jamie. She was just beautiful. And set the template for every female after that. Like, brunette, kind of awkward, a little nerdy, very intelligent. But
20.
She was, yeah. She was the most popular girl in our grade. And she ran for student council president, and so did her boyfriend, Brad. They were the power couple, and I wanted her. And he got her because he was good looking, and I was chubby and weird. And and
I loved memes.
And so
I kept telling people about this, you know, impact font on pictures.
So friend zoned by this girl in fifth grade before I knew what the friend zone was, and I won student council president.
Boom.
I beat them both for fifth grade. I lied.
Yeah, I was gonna say you made some campaign promises.
I lied
out there
and said that there would be Coke machines, and that I would install them. And Mrs. Bennett, who I loved. Ryan, her grandson, may actually listen to the podcast. I love Mrs. Bennett. And she leans over and she's like, listen, you can't make that happen. And I just looked at her and I said, I know I can't. But I need this. It's all I have.
And then you called the Koch brothers and they turned you down for the money. Yeah. And
classic mix-up.
Classic mix-up.
I remember this very distinctly at Brentwood Elementary. Chris promised to make our elementary school great again. And he wasn't able to fulfill that obligation.
I will. If you go to the We Are Libertarians Facebook...
Let that be a lesson, everybody.
Actually, if you look me up on Facebook, Chris Spangle, you'll be able to see my campaign posters. I'll make that photo album public and you can check that out. So.
My favorite thing about when you post over back Thursdays from elementary school are you have circled yourself in every yearbook and put me.
Yeah.
Because you may not know it's you.
I might have dementia someday.
That's a good point.
Long history of Alzheimer's in my family. So yeah, I think that the socialization process of public schools is not great, but I don't necessarily know that it's any better. I mean, my cousin was homeschooled and she seems to have turned out fine. But at the time, growing up, she seemed to be a fairly lonely kid and didn't have a lot of friends. So what kind of options are there in terms of socialization for homeschool kids now?
Oh, there
it's,
are tons.
I think that's the main roadblock for a lot of people.
It's, well, honestly, my wife figured this out very early on. You almost spend most of your day. A lot of people spend so much time worrying about that that's all they do. I mean, it's incredible. He can still do you know, sports. The IHSAA here in Indiana, there's still regulations that allow homeschoolers to play sports with them. There's all, like, we live in I literally live right down the road, dude. I didn't realize how close we were.
Oh, wow.
But Franklin Township, I mean, they have all their sports leagues and stuff. He played soccer with them. He does karate. My wife, really before social media took off, she started a Yahoo group, a meetup group in Yahoo. And it expanded into a Facebook group, and they literally have, like, play dates at Southeast Way Park. They do field trips all the time with all these other kids. I mean, they went to Chicago's Pizza one time. The kids got to go in the back and make their own pizza before they opened up. But they go to museums
better
together.
And more like a more real
one. We're talking like 10 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so they're still doing all that stuff. They do it whenever they want. They do field trip. It's just, it's incredible the amount of stuff that they still get to do. And then on top of that, she is a tutor at a co-op here on the southeast side. And it's broken up into, to get in depth with it, it's called Classical Conversations.
Okay.
And it's rooted in Christianity. And I'll come right up front and say I'm kind of agnostic myself, but it's a great program. I mean, I love the program. But she's a tutor there, and what they do is they do break you up into age groups. It's not just the 12-month thing. It spans a couple years. And one day a week they meet up, and it's 8 to noon or 9 to noon. They meet up, and they go over basic – they'll do history. They learn Latin. They do science. They'll
do
a timeline.
So it's the model of like the traditional classical liberal arts education.
It is. Exactly. It is. That's what it is. I mean, they're already talking about, you know, Newton and Plato and stuff like that. And that's where a lot of that's rooted in.
Yeah, all of it.
And it's, oh, exactly. Yeah. But, I mean, it's incredible. But, I mean, so they get together in their kind of age groups there. So they do get some of that age group experience, but it's once a week. It's a tutor thing. She's not a teacher. She's a tutor. They basically kind of set them up with what they're going to work on that week. And then they go home, and that's what they work on with their parents for the week. And then, and then they expand it from there. You know, if you want more math, she goes through all, you know, finds different types of curriculum for math. And something else, too, is, you know, and this was a big reason for me, is no two kids learn alike. They are so much different. My daughter and my son have completely different learning styles. I mean, my daughter loves doing worksheets. My son, if you put a math worksheet in front of him, he's going to sit there all day, and you'll get two answers out of him, you know. And so just how they learn is so much different. I mean, whether it's, you know, watching a video and then writing a report about it, blogging, doing a YouTube video, explaining something. And that's something else they do in their classes. They have to do public speaking every class.
And that is huge.
It is.
That puts you so far ahead of the curve going into college and life
out there.
It is.
Is public speaking.
I was campaigning at the time when they first started doing it, and I'm a horrible public speaker. It's probably no surprise to anybody here. I mean, I was terrible at it. I was afraid.
Well, there's usually not a guy trolling Brett while you're trying to say your first words every time when you campaign.
That's true. It wasn't that bad.
Chris wasn't back there dying laughing. Little Brett Bittner in his slow moves.
He was a stealth-faced learner.
I got better and better at it as I went on, and basically learned to quit taking notes and just wing it. And I actually got pretty good at it. But my son inspired me. The first time I had a chance, because it's in the middle of the day, the first time I had a chance to go sit down on his class, and I think I even posted on my campaign page. But I sat down, and he got up in front of the class and just totally nailed it. I mean, the way he interacted with everybody in the room as he was talking and explained what he wanted to do, and it was just out of nowhere. It's like, hey, what are you going to talk about? And he just went up and just winged it.
No learned fear of social judgment.
Exactly. I mean, it was incredible. And it's great to develop that. And, you know, he likes going around and doing taking videos and explaining what he's doing. He started out on his little Nintendo DS. It can take videos. And now, we decided, you know what, we got him a camera. You can have your own YouTube channel. He does, you know, video blogging. He does a lot of blogging and stuff like that. I mean, it's...
Wow.
It's incredible. And he's 8.
He's smarter than you.
He is. I'm not going to argue with you.
Well, see, so one of the things that I remember from my homeschool experience was the co-op aspect, and it was to help essentially give other perspectives and to give people who have strengths other than your primary educator an opportunity to help you along.
They do. They find somebody who knows how to teach this subject.
Exactly.
And there's a lot of, in my the group that my wife created outside of the classical conversations. I mean, there's former teachers in there, mm-hmm. public school teachers and stuff in there. So there's somebody that's really strong in certain subjects.
Disillusioned with what they...
Like, well, and exactly. That's what a lot of it is. But so they do that. She'll do meetups at the library where they go into the conference room at the library and, you know, exchange curriculum, materials, books, you know, discuss different ideas.
There's even a website, Teachers Paying Teachers, where they can pay for different lessons. I mean, like unlimited resources.
Oh, the Khan Academy. It's Khan Academy.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
But there's also, you brought up curriculum, which always kind of gives me a little bit of a – it irks me. Because I don't know that you necessarily need to have a curriculum.
We don't.
Right.
It's so mixed up what we do.
And I've talked to Renee. I've talked to Renee about
how
that works.
It's just a mental thing.
Renee's my wife, in case anybody's wondering.
But, you know, unschooling is something that's very popular among libertarians because it takes away all of the structure that you would see for kids that aren't going to necessarily excel in that structure. And this is one of the things that libertarian homeschooler talks about. There's the unschool bus. There's probably 10 different.
Peter Thiel awarded $100,000 to that a genius award or whatever for people doing cutting edge work for unschooling.
Mm-hmm. Right, and because you really get the opportunity to do what every other educational effort fails at, and that's individualized education, tailored. It's absolutely tailored to your kid. And you're not using anybody else's curriculum. You're not using, you know, there are great things out there. Like Tom Woods has a great curriculum.
Mm-hmm. Ron Paul does, to my knowledge.
Yeah, that's Tom Woods.
Oh, that's the Tom Woods?
Tom Woods
actually puts it together.
I've heard about unschooling a lot. Can you go kind of in depth on what that is? Because I think a lot of our listeners may have heard of it, but they may not totally understand how that actually works.
As somebody who's not a parent, I don't have hands-on experience with it, but I've done quite a bit of research from an interest perspective, especially when I was on the school board, to see how you are able to really affect positive change in the life of a child. And the thing about it is you focus on what the kid wants to focus on, and you incorporate the things that they need to know based on their interests. And so you introduce it in a way that is specialized for them, in a way that they're going to understand it because you understand how they learn. And it's not like you have a structured time from 9 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. that you're going to be working on math and science and language arts and history. Those are going to be the four things that you do on a Wednesday. You may go to the park and look, you know, go through
learn about
the trails.
Gravity.
Well, you go hiking and you see something and you talk
and
about
you,
it. And
you learn about
so
it.
So it's a little more experiential than
very
much
look
so.
At that bird.
Yeah,
we're here to learn about
right.
You know,
can you imagine?
It's self-directed. Big
yeah.
Time.
Well, and think
so
about
so it's similar in the initial foundations, the Montessori.
Very much so.
Yes.
But then it changes, obviously,
very much
beyond
so.
That. But
and so one of the beautiful things about it is your kid gets to learn about things that they're interested in at a pace that they can handle it. And
can learn
it's
it.
Individualized. And you don't have that situation where you're saying, don't look at that bird. We're not studying birds this week. We're studying trees.
Right.
Well, you got to focus on the trees. Well, you can actually talk about nature and you can find something that's interesting and you happen to come upon a bird that you've never seen before. You look it up, you find out more about it, and you learn about it. But you have all these experiences that really help do a lot more than being focused on the number of minutes that a child is in a seat.
Right.
What's funny is every time like I talk about this to people, all that sounds like is like these models just make your kid like to learn.
It's exactly the
fundamental, most important thing that you can ever take away.
It's not making them like to learn. They love to learn.
They never get it instilled that learning sucks.
That's the thing.
And
you let them keep loving to learn. And that's the biggest thing. My son, I mean, we don't shut him. And I say, it is we, but my wife spends so much more time with him since I'm at work. But we don't shut it down. You know, if he wants to run with something, we run with it. And what we do, you talk about unschooling, we kind of do a hybrid because we have the co-op. There's a lot of that classical model of education. Like, I mean, it's, you know, it was, I say popular in the Enlightened era, but in the Enlightenment period. But, you know, I mean, it was, I guess, the top few that were doing it. But it's rooted heavily in that, and they do a lot of that. But it's also just seriously, just like he was talking about birds. I mean, we have a woods, a field, train tracks behind us. We see owls and hawks and everything else back there, and that's exactly what it is. I mean, they have binoculars by the window. They look out there. They find it. They ask what kind it is. They, you know, they look it up online. They learn about it. And next thing you know, we're going to, what's the Indiana Raptor organization? I can't think of it.
Oh, I don't know.
They go around with the owls and the hawks and DNR. You know, all that. Yeah, something. There's some program like that.
Aviarian, I mean, Avarian Society?
It's
or,
something. Yeah.
Like
something.
You're not just sitting there looking in a science book. This is an owl.
Right, exactly.
This is what owls eat.
I mean, they go and find, they look it up and then they go find them.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's incredible.
One of the things that I wanted to share was actually a conversation that I had with the Libertarian Homeschooler, where she was talking about the new job that the Young Statesman has and all the stuff that he's doing as he kind of moves towards focusing on music. She said that at this point, she can't really teach him anything when it comes to the musicianship. It's not her forte. And her exact quote was, "I just go along to hold his luggage and get sandwiches." Mm-hmm. But that's the way that she's able to facilitate it,
right?
Because she's found experts that are going to help him. They're going to help him with music theory. They're going to help him with directing the choir. They're going to help him with playing the organ. They're going to help him with playing all the instruments that he's interested in and being a true musician. And he wants to be a church musician. And that's the way that that's what they're supporting, because it's what he has found to be interesting. And it's what's driving him to learn. And it's going to be, and this is the key, I think, for a lot of kids as they become adults, is you don't stop learning. I continue to read. Mm-hmm. I'm always watching interesting things.
I'd argue I've learned more since high school than I did in high school.
Oh, that, well, yeah, once that intellectual curiosity sparked, there's right. no putting that out right, or saying exactly. I'm bored with this.
So you guys are talking about a lot of work.
not really.
And so I think a lot of parents don't want to homeschool their kids because they think, well, gosh, this is going to be a lot of work, or this is going to cost a lot of money, or this is going to be, you know, money and time, I think, are really the main factors, especially since we live in a society where both parents have to work anymore.
Right.
You know, when my grandparents, my grandmother could stay home, both of them could stay home and raise the kids. And then my parents, it was mostly optional. But they really did need a
the
second
mommy
income.
Wars of Hillary Clinton in that era, right? Like the early 90s.
But now, both parents have to have an income for us to survive.
And sadly, the second income that's happening with a lot of those parents just goes to cover daycare after school.
Yeah, that's it.
It's a huge portion.
My friend Matt and Stacy, they saved like $100 a month by her not working anymore.
Right.
So I think that's the question that a lot of parents would have. It sounds worth it. It would benefit my child to homeschool, but I don't have the time or the money, Chris.
Well, that's another debate we had. When we had my first son, my wife worked. She did a medical billing and coding. And it doesn't pay great, but if she was doing it now and we had two kids in daycare, that's where a lot of that money would go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I would say the majority of it would go. She worked at before right up until the time my daughter was born, she worked over at St. Francis Hospital in the cancer clinic over there. And that's where a lot of that money would go. And that was a debate and honestly, it was a very short debate we had, because we realized that it was worth it and we were going to do it. And I wasn't making a lot of money at the time. I would argue I'm still not, but I wasn't making as much then as I am now.
Now he's the Trump of We Are Libertarian.
Because it wouldn't have been an option at that point, like right out of the gate, or no?
Honestly, it would have. I mean, I think we would have done it anyways. We would have cut back or did whatever we had to do to make it work. And it was one of those sacrifices we had to make. I mean, I didn't take a vacation forever. We didn't go anywhere. You know, we budgeted really hard. But if we had to do it all over again, I know absolutely both of us would say we'd do it again.
Yeah.
You know, it was totally worth it just to see what it did for the kids. And I kept chipping it away and did what I had to do to kind of make up for that lost income. But so it is a sacrifice. And I would argue our neighbor is widowed and she has a son. And I would argue, or my sister's a single mother. And that's a situation where it's like, you know what, you have to go to work and they have to go to public school.
Yeah.
And it's great to have that option. I'm not ever advocating taking that away. But I mean, we made it work. You can make it work. It is possible. It's a lot of work. It is a sacrifice. You have to put them first. and you know just look ahead. But
isn't that your job as a parent?
Oh, absolutely.
To put them first?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's not, and I shouldn't call it a sacrifice at all. That is, I would say, your duty as a parent. Absolutely.
Right. It is why I'm not a parent.
And it's one of the reasons that I'm not a parent.
You know that that's something you have to work at.
Right.
You know, you're right. And you brought up how much work is homeschooling. It is a lot of work. Now, it's what you make of it. It's what your kids give you and what you have to work with and where you want to go with it. It's whatever you want it to be. If you decide, like my wife, it's a lot of work for my wife because she's got two kids that learn two different completely ways.
She had to become a teacher.
Well, and then she does the co-op thing. So she's preparing classes and lectures. And I call them lectures. She teaches the kindergarten class, which my daughter's in. But she has to do the material for that. And honestly, that's actually what's great. Another reason that she had against homeschooling when we started out was, and I've heard this from so many moms, is I'm not smart enough to do that. I don't know how to teach my kids that stuff because I don't know it myself.
No.
But there's so many resources.
Well,
and
not only that, but
go to a college education class.
What she's learned in the process, you know, when she learns with the kids, I mean, she tries to get ahead of the curve. If my son's taken off in something, when he goes to bed, she's watching documentaries on that subject, you know, or if she's got something she has to teach in class, she's, you know, reading up on it. I mean, she said in history class when she went to Cecina, the teacher in that class was the football coach. He literally came in.
That's what it is.
It was the same way at New Pal. It's exactly the way it works.
My high school physics teacher was a coach.
Yeah, and so he'd come in, put a video on, and go sit in the back of the class and
draw
plays.
This is the Patriot.
You know?
Mel Gibson's character didn't exist, but this is what happened during the Revolution. You know what I mean? Like, yeah.
So I'm interested to hear how it's changed your wife.
Honestly, it blows me away at what she knows. She is, I would argue, whether it's philosophically, principled, whatever, she is a bigger advocate for homeschooling than I am. Mm-hmm. I mean, I am. I would take credit for getting her to change her views on that, but it's incredible. I mean, she wouldn't do it any other way. And just what she's learned, I mean, it's unreal. She could not remember anything. I remember conversations we had right after we got married. I was in the military, and I'm trying to explain to her where Iraq is. And why there was an Iraq war and what happened in the 80s and what, you know.
When Saddam was our partner.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, it's blowing her mind. And now it's like the stuff she's telling me that I'm learning from her about, you know, the Roman Empire. I mean, it blows me away. I didn't learn that stuff.
No.
I've tried to read up on it, but what she already knows about it blows me away.
Like, literally, the high school, we had world history, and I took it, and I remember, like, very vague, you know, stuff from it, but like
it was the football coach.
You know, but Ron Swanson, all of history was a mistake until 1776.
Yeah.
Like, that's the American public school education for history. Is like everything happened, and then these incredible men, decided they dumped a bunch of tea in the Boston Harbor, and all of a sudden we had freedom was discovered in the world for the first time ever.
Yeah, you learn about the Egyptians, the Romans. You learn about Greece.
Ben Carson didn't learn about the Egyptians, clearly.
Right. But you never learn about the Babylonians. You never learn about, you know, and then you stop at World War. You barely get to World War II. You don't know anything about the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Right.
You don't know anything about these foundational happenings in a high school education.
They don't have those history books yet
in your
public schools. So.
Right.
Well, it's little excerpts and blurbs that you'd get on a picture on the internet, and that's what you. Now, can you remember and memorize this? Spit it out, or just be able to pick it out of a select or a group of choices.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And now you know history. You're a historian.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, I remember. I mean, it was probably first or second grade, and we had three reading levels, and I was at the bottom. I was at like yellow, and then there was orange, and there was red, and my mom found out that I was in the bottom of the thing after a PT, a parent-teacher night, and a PTN, as the kids call it. And we spent a month going through all these workbooks, and I was to the top of the reading list because of post-school stuff. And I was that's really what ignited my love of reading, which turned into a love of learning, which turned into... And I'm a naturally curious person. And
all libertarians in that why element, You know, yeah. I feel like that's a very common trait.
I think all people yeah. originate right. that way.
They just get it beat out of them. Right. Quit it. You're annoying yeah. people.
Well, can right. you imagine Obey. What it's yeah. like to be told that your where you excel isn't going to, it doesn't meet what they think you should be excelling
right.
at? We don't have people who are out there encouraging people to be artists or encouraging people to be musicians because they aren't doing well in math or science.
Yeah.
You don't do well in math or science is because you're dumb, mm-hmm.
right.
is what they're taught, but they may have an amazing talent elsewhere and an interest elsewhere. And, you know, if you or I are bad at drawing or bad at painting, it just means that we don't really excel in the arts. But when you take that to some of the other things that kids are learning, you're dumb. And that's the way that it's presented to you.
Yeah, natural talents
for not being able to do that, and you're not able to expand on mm-hmm. the things that where you can excel and where you actually have an interest.
I also think, you know, consistency is so important for kids, and you have one teacher, and a teacher that knows you intimately and yes. that can guide you. I remember in high school, I mean, I was terrible at math, and I was just clicking through my math teachers. And I had the same math teacher, Mr. Pearson, for four straight semesters, which was unheard of.
Oh, wow.
And then I really got used to him, and I really struggled with math because I really struggled to give a shit, and I never did homework, and I just didn't care. I mean, I was getting straight A's in English and history yes. and social studies, but math, forget it, because I just didn't care.
Hey, Chris, I was a mathlete.
Of course you were, with your little bowl haircut.
I'm with you, Chris.
And then I went to Mr. Clapp, who...
My favorite.
Oh, you're all... you're probably like the worst class I've ever had. You're probably all going to fail this. And he just... And he would get mad
He's
at...
He's a great troll. He would Everyone would get all upset, and I just felt like I knew he wasn't serious.
Yeah, and like our friend, my friend Matt, he really wanted to get it. And he really had a lot of questions. And Mr. Clapp would just get frustrated because it kept bugging him. And I got a D in that class. That was the first time I ever had a D in any high school, and I just was so depressed. And it's just because he wasn't into being a teacher anymore. And
no, you know, the end was in sight because he retired the year after, and I was a year yeah. behind Chris at Plainfield. He retired the year after I graduated.
Yeah, God rest his soul. He's yeah. passed on now, but so I guess I should say he was a great teacher. I don't know.
I don't know. I liked him, but.
Yeah,
different experiences.
But again, yeah, like Mr. Pearson, having so much time with me, figured out how to get me to enjoy a subject that I hated.
Yeah.
And Mr. Clapp knew he was going to have me for 6 months and just didn't have the energy level to devote to students who didn't get it. Stephanie Jackson did great. She got all kinds of attention because she was a mathlete too.
You're not better.
Stephanie Jackson got yeah. also got a lot of attention from me. Yeah.
No, I did terrible in school. I mean, I was a horrible student, especially in elementary. And it's the same way. Like, you know, in elementary, at least you do get to spend a year with that teacher.
Mm.
But it was up and down. I'd have a good year where I'd have a teacher that I clicked with. I had a bad year where I had a teacher that I didn't click with. And then I got into high school, and I was the same way. I was terrible in math. I mean, I did the very minimal algebra I had to do to graduate. But... I mean, I nailed history, and I nailed English and literature. I took drafting. I loved drafting. I was great at it. Horrible in math. I mean, it completely just drug down my GPA and everything else. But it must be the name, right? But elementary, you know, I got in trouble so many times because I was either reading or drawing. You know, I wasn't doing my multiplication worksheets. I was reading and drawing. Well, but, I mean, my kids get to read and draw all they want.
Right. Right. Because you're encouraging what they're naturally interested in.
Right.
And you're able to incorporate that into not even just teaching, but just, as Greg put it at the very beginning of when we started talking about it, it inspires that desire to learn.
Yes.
And I really think, like, once you set that, your job's done.
Right.
I mean, other yeah. than to be the tutor, the guide,
right.
you know,
yeah.
facilitate,
mm-hmm. yeah.
you know.
And
if you can do that model and scale it, you can just fix, across the board,
yeah.
revolution in education that we so clearly need as we just continually fall.
I would encourage, if you haven't or any of your listeners haven't, I would absolutely encourage reading John Holt. He was a teacher.
Founder, right?
Unschooling. He kind of kicked that off. Yeah. He had a newsletter.
In like
but
the
when it was incredibly, he was a public school teacher in the 60s, I think in the early 70s. Mm-hmm. It was homeschooling was incredibly unpopular, and unschooling was
even less popular. Yeah,
and he really didn't even write a book on the subject until like in the early 80s. Yeah. He died in 85. But great work. There's a lot of good books out there. The last one I read with my last job, I traveled a lot and I read a lot. The last one I read was Unschooling Rules, and it is a great book. I mean, it's full of insight on just how to basically let your kids free and let them take off like that. But it's.
You might be more familiar with this than I, but was the history or like so the origin? He really made it academically credible, mm-hmm. and then set off like a spark that sure. now's kind of culminated to mm-hmm. what is it like 2 million kids are homeschooled in the United States?
I think it's a bigger number than that.
It's larger than that.
Yeah, it's really catchy. I want to say it's at least 3, possibly 4.
I can't remember. I don't remember what the number is.
Clearly, but. it's no long. I think like a lot of the issues and. Problems people had early on, and this is where our jokes about Brett come from, is it was a sampling error. The sampling size was too low because it was kids who were being, or for whatever reason were struggling or being bullied, and it wasn't that homeschooling made them have much different social manners and characteristics. It was those existed, and that's why they were in homeschooling.
Well, and that's right. In the 80s and 90s, that's what a lot of it was. Yeah. It was conservatism. It was sheltering.
Parents that were worried about their kids getting in with the wrong crowd.
It is.
School.
It was.
Protectionist.
And that still exists. I mean, I know parents that's their reasoning, and to an
and that's
extent,
their
that's
reasoning
not,
for private schooling.
And, exactly, and or charter schools or whatever, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, right. It's like you guys talked about your experiences in public school. I mean, if you want to get them away from that and find a different way, then I mean, by all means. But a lot of it now is just finding a better education model. And that's what so much of it, I think between 2005, here in Indiana, between 2005 and now, so 10 years, it's the amount of homeschoolers has doubled.
Yeah.
I mean, it's grown like a percent, but the actual amount has doubled of home, by population. But
so we're going to start wrapping this up. So you two, and Greg, what? You can weigh in too, but give us your top reasons why you think you should homeschool your kids. Actually, before we do that, one question. I mean, what if your kids are like 8? What if your kids are 14? I mean, can you experience this being mm-hmm. older and going to homeschooling and that right. transition? I mean, what if you've got older kids and how do you transition them? And that's one of your big concerns.
Well, I don't think that it really should be a concern because I don't think there's a point where you're too late to start that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that there's a point that's too early either. Both my sister and I were. Essentially, I mean, we were able to read before we got to kindergarten. My mom made sure of that.
Right.
So it wasn't necessarily an issue of lack of interest. It wasn't necessarily a lack of we looked for what would work for me because I was such a difficult fit when it came to school.
Sure.
Because, until kindergarten, I didn't talk to anybody outside my family.
Hmm.
And that
you were that kid, huh?
Well, it wasn't just that. I mean, that was actually one of the things they thought they wanted to put me in remedial education because I didn't communicate verbally with people. But if they put it on paper in front of me, I was able to read it, which they didn't think that I could do because I was just coming into kindergarten and that.
Right.
So for me, it was always trying to find the best solution. And so I went to a different school in first grade than I did in second grade, than I did in kindergarten, than I did in third grade. Fourth grade was homeschool. Fifth grade was the Christian school where we found the model that seemed to work best for me.
Right.
And then at that point, we just weren't able to. It was an economic decision. There, I couldn't go anymore because it would have been two different schools for two different kids at two different times, and we couldn't afford both.
Right.
But I think that there's no point that's too late to get started. Because you really do have the opportunity to make a positive difference, even if it is your 10th grade year. I mean, I wish that after 8th grade that I would have just taken the GED and moved on and done other things, but I wouldn't have had all of the experiences that I had extracurricularly. Some of them were in school and some of them were outside. I played sports. I was involved in the arts. I took karate. I, wanted to roller skate all the time. And, I was I had a variety of interests. And it was all because my mom wanted to make sure that every need that I had was met. whether mm-hmm. it was educationally, socially, or experientially. And so I don't think that there is a point that's too late, but we started with all of that stuff before I was even in like pre-K.
Yeah.
I mean, I was reading, my sister and I were both reading by the time we were three.
Right.
My sister is a crazy reader. She reads all the time. She probably reads 2 books a week, and she's 30.
Wow.
She turns 30 this year.
You're right, saying it's never too late. I argue I was public school until I was 18, and then I was unschooled after that. And
right.
I think I did all of my learning after that. I mean, right. That's like the natural state for people mm-hmm. is to, you know, to want to learn. You
right.
know, I mean, that's
because
where our
once,
kids start out. And
once
that's,
school stopped holding us back,
yes.
we were actually able
yeah,
to learn.
I could go read.
This isn't learning.
Right.
This doesn't have to
it's
be
a
terrible.
Focus. Once I was stopped, once I was stopped, they stopped forcing me to do rote memorization. Then I went to college and learned how to critically think, and that's when my mm-hmm. whole world changed.
Sure.
And I found a whole new set of skills in college that I didn't have in high school because I was thinking in a, different way. I was, you know, I wasn't judged on how much I could memorize, which I have a great memory, and I'm an audiographic learner, so if I hear it, I remember it. First time, I just pick it up. It's like having a photographic memory only with audio. And so I would succeed in class, and I'd get B's just because I remembered everything I heard in a class, but I couldn't read because I was so ADD.
Well, and you brought up memory, and that's kind of one of the things that Classical Conversations does, is there is a lot of memory work there, but it's like it's basically the trivium. You memorize the timeline, but then you expand off of that.
Right.
You remember, okay, in 1492, this happened. But then
you have a mental map.
But exactly.
Right.
Then you start building off of that, and you get into that rhetoric stage and on. But it's I love it. I mean, it's incredible.
That's, like, you know, that's
my,
as good a gift as you
daughter.
Could give.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's unreal.
So top reasons to homeschool your kids.
I would say I think my biggest argument has been, and I said it earlier, is no two kids are alike. They everybody has a different demand, a different learning style, what they need, what works, and you want to be in the best position to develop that and let them flourish. You just can't do that in a public school, and it's not a knock on public school. I mean, there are kids that thrive in that system, but there are a whole lot of kids, and I would argue a majority of them, that they do not. They're not learning the way that they want to learn or the way they wanted to learn when they wanted to learn.
It's preventative to their success.
It right. is. And I have to echo exactly what Chris said. It's all about individualizing the education to the kid, and that's one of the things that in a larger format where you have 28, 32 kids in a classroom, you're not going to be able to give Chris Spangle the individualized attention that he needs to make sure that he's excelling everywhere, and you're not able to feed what Chris needs. He's an audiographic learner.
Mm-hmm.
That's very different than mm-hmm. probably 30 of the kids in that 32-kid classroom. Not everybody learns that way. And so you're able to individualize your education. You're not looking at a one-size-fits-all, top-down ideal mm-hmm. of what should be, where they kind of aim for the middle
mm-hmm.
and they end up hitting the bottom.
Yep.
And so I have to say that the biggest reason to homeschool your kids would be to provide them with an individualized education that focuses on what they want their life to be. I look at homeschool kids, and they know far earlier in their life what they want to do, how they want to do it, and how they're going to get there.
What right. they're good at.
Than, you know, the 18 to 22-year-olds who are making huge decisions about their life all of a sudden when a year before they had to raise their hand to get permission to go to the bathroom.
I mean,
right?
I honestly did not understand. I mean, I honestly didn't understand most of my skills and what I was good at until 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Four yep. years ago, and I'm 32. I mean, I didn't even really appreciate certain things about myself that are major, like my intelligence, until there was someone that I dated earlier this year that really helped me see, oh yeah, you are actually a smart person. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's you're constantly learning and growing, and I think you have a much better chance if almost you're an apprentice to a parent. So I'm all for homeschooling. I think it's great and should be encouraged. Greg, any final thoughts?
I mean, for me, ultimately, the reason I wanted to, one, have Chris on and talk about this topic is not something we fleshed out very well or had first-hand experience with, But two is the overarching theme is that for many people, homeschooling is the first taste of liberty or libertarianism or self-governance that most people are exposed to.
Right.
And I think the moment they are, it changes the mindset for everyone and sort of spreads liberty and is something that is, you know, the Ron Paul Institute, Tom Woods' curriculum and the people Brett's familior with, the young anarchists or the baby anarchists.
Baby anarchists, yeah. The young statesmen, the libertarian homeschoolers.
And like as those people hit critical mass and continue to be recurring themes in society and media, you're going to see a trend towards government, and you're already seeing it, but anti-government or anti-public education, one size fits all. Because the world we live in is the world of customization. You can get everything customized.
Right.
And to think that you can't get your education customized or that you need to pay, what is it? $6,000 per pupil for a public education, which is dramatically less than the $500 to $600 the average homeschooler parent pays per year.
Wow, that's a pretty cheap school at $6,000.
Right. And you know, like we're making progress in things like school choice, where you get to go to a charter school or a similar type institution. I mean, someone like Chris's situation, your wife could take your niece or nephew, whoever, you know, and then get the money, the voucher to administer education. And all the worries of financial costs go away.
Sure.
And that's the way early education was in the United States. It was privately administered, a lot of times religiously administered if there was an outside agent. But then if you look at the parents
paid for the teacher's salary.
Right.
I mean, and it was direct.
They went and found the teacher.
Right.
They went and recruited a teacher.
And then brought the teacher to them.
Exactly.
If you saw Back to the Future 3, Clara was brought
to Clara Barton.
Hill Valley.
Yes.
No, Clara Clayton.
Clayton.
Was brought to Hill Valley.
That's right.
To teach. Before and but then she was supposed to go over into the ravine and
Doc Brown does what he does.
Doc Brown does what he does.
The rest is history.
Yeah. Yes, but you know, no, that's exactly right. And then a guy that's a hero of mine is William F. Buckley, the founder of the National Review. So his history is interesting. So he comes from a wealthy family in Mexico during a revolution. They're forced to flee. His dad's an attorney and founder of a oil company or a mining company. They end up settling, trying to become a part of the American Northeast upper crust, and they settle up in Connecticut. Well, because they were new money and looked so ragged upon, they didn't get into any of the private schools. Public schools are their only option, and their dad was having none of it. So they actually started a school at their house. Their house ended up, the school ended up becoming so popular, the neighborhoods, the fellow people in the neighborhood asked if their kids could come there and be schooled, and ultimately they created like a sustainable model. Out of being rejected by the private schools and, you know, taking your education into your own hands. And it, to me, if a parent had the option to say, listen, I know this individual, I know Renee Mayo, and I would just, you know, the attention she would give and help my child's education over a private school or a public school, I have no option but to pick her.
Right.
And then you would, I mean, you dramatically change the educational model from the bottom up.
And one of the things that's happening now, and one of the things that the Friedman Foundation for Educational Choice is working on, is one of their biggest focuses has been educational savings accounts and the money following the child.
Yep.
So you may not get every dollar that would be picked, and $6,000 is very low. You have, there's a, in New Jersey, I forget the town, but they spend $19,000 per pupil.
Oh, Newark School District?
No, it's not Newark, but it's very New Jersey.
I think it is Trenton. Isn't it?
Yeah, I don't.
Yeah,
but
is it the one Zuckerberg donated all the money to?
Small
yes,
state. You're
that's
get
the
there.
One.
Yeah.
So, if you're able to have the money follow the child, can you imagine the resources that are available to you and the economy that it would create? Because right now you have a bunch of educrats who are just yes men to the people who come to the school board meetings where they are proposing the latest and greatest. And I posted a comic on my Facebook about this specifically, where they come to you and they make this correlation and present it as causation. And they focus everything. It's something about how 90% of engineers played with or rebuilt clocks when they were kids. And then you see the schools then saying, well, we need to focus on clocks. And everything becomes about clocks and because they're behind in engineering and they've become so focused on the clock work that it becomes their clock.
Everybody's an engineer, damn it. We're going to learn clocks.
Right.
Screw you, Ahmed. You're a terrorist.
Right. Next thing you know, you're meeting the president.
But it gives you an idea of what happens. There's an idea that's there that people are presenting as fact, that this leads to this, so you need to do more of this. Mm-hmm. And when
next time I hear that, I'm going to say, well, 100% of school shooters went to public school. Yep. What is your counterargument?
But what they end up doing is they end up selling these boards and superintendents and very a lot of whom are very well-meaning people. They just don't understand that just because somebody presents an idea to you mm-hmm. and presents it in a way that correlation is causation, that you're going to get the results that you think you're going to get.
Right. Yeah.
Because you become so focused on that one thing, that one silver bullet, because everything is presented as if it's the panacea. It's going to solve all of our educational problems.
This is the single thing and amongst every kid that is so beloved, it will right. change everyone.
Everything. But everything is that way
yeah.
when it comes to government education. And so if you can eliminate that
yeah.
by having money follow the child, you'll see that you'll see co-ops and schools that form because Chris's kids are, they have money now. They can, they can build out a little schoolhouse. I'm not saying that that's sure. what you would do, but
hypothetically, yeah.
hypothetically speaking,
become an administrator, start ignoring children. The cycle repeats itself.
But when you have a focus on individualized education, you're not necessarily going to be looking at that because you have a foundation. And the way that you and Renee work with your kids, same way that I see Anna and Don working with the Young Statesman, Baby Anarchist, John Mons, who I've talked about before, all four of his kids, who were probably the most well-behaved kids I've ever met. His oldest was just is following in his dad's footsteps and is a legacy at Morehouse. I have a friend who works for a congressman. Her four kids are absolutely brilliant, and she said that she spent $1,400 a year for four kids mm-hmm. to homeschool them.
Right.
There's so much more efficiency. And if you're able to just the little bit of resources that you can put towards it, you're gonna see amazing results.
Sure. And support the reforms that need to be made. Like even if it's not the voucher, a tax credit for the mm-hmm. same amount, if that's the way you want to do it, or
anything.
Charter schools are becoming overregulated.
And that's where I'm kind of on the fence about any financial support on my end, homeschooling. In Indiana, the best we can get is if I take all of our receipts from our co-op and everything, our books, and take them in, I can get a deduction on that. But I can't claim any credits for it. And part of me says that's okay because Indiana is very, very lax about homeschooling, the regulation of it. If you ever go to the Indiana Department of Education, their rules, they say this is what we'd like to see, but we don't enforce it. That's basically
– based on their track record, they don't really have great grounds to lecture.
That's exactly – and I want to keep it that way. I do want to keep it that way.
Which is sad that we want to stay out of the ire.
Exactly, yeah.
Right. That should be the exact opposite.
I will take the kick in the nuts financially to keep them out of it.
Yeah.
Well, because if what Chris and Renee are doing for their kids becomes popular enough – and it does get funding.
It's going to get trendy.
You're going to see that there are regulations about what you have to do and the things that you have to provide. And
charter school, right now.
They come knocking on your door all the time.
You're already seeing that now with charter schools.
Yeah. And it's like this most recent study, Cato comes out and says, yes, 2015 wasn't the best year for, school choice.
Uh-huh.
But, don't let
Except
this take
in Nevada,
away.
Where it was right. awesome.
Yeah, don't let this take away from the incredible gains it's made to this point. There's one study by self-selected, and then the big issue is the demographic makeup.
Mm-hmm.
That's the killer. It's the rich white kids fleeing the public schools. Of course they perform better. They performed better in the public schools too, and propped it up.
Well, and it's actually funny. The group that my wife started out that started on Yahoo and ended up as a Facebook group, and they meet up. It's the economic diversity there is it's crazy. There's people that I see them wearing the same clothes every day because they can't afford anything else, and then I see people with $400,000 and $500,000 brick homes and everything else. I think that's part of the growth of it, where there is more diversity in it. It is not the same demographic anymore. I have seen more minorities participating mm-hmm. in it. Maybe not to the extent.
Yeah, that's up. That's one stat. It's up to 15% minority or non-white.
It is growing. And homeschooling and even that demographic, it's never going to overcome public schooling.
You take a look at the popularity of historically black colleges.
Yeah.
Within the
African American
community.
Which are racist and I don't support.
But there's a certain element of growth and community that happens there. And I think that you'll start to see that as you need individualized education for your kid, as you realize that that's there, you're able to provide it because you are actively involved as a parent.
Which is always the number one criticism by the public school supporters is blame the parent.
Right.
So great. Now we actually have the parent teaching.
Yeah.
You still like that? You want to talk about parent engagement more? How about we have them teach it and you stay home?
Let them do it.
Yeah. Don't worry. If you're really good, we'll get money and you can start your own place.
Sure.
And all your approved status lesson plans can go ahead and see if you can get kids there. But really, it just exists to support the existing system.
Right.
Which... that's always the toughest battle to win. Mm-hmm. Because the second it becomes, that gets dicey, it becomes, all this money's missing because all these white kids are homeschooling, and we allowed them to have vouchers, and why are you all a bunch of racists that school your kids?
Literally, right. In inner city schools around the country, the first few days of school, it is all about going out and getting kids, getting bodies in seats so they can get funding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They have crews of people that go and round people up. And it's not just in The Wire, because that's an actual thing that happens. So you see that in The Wire, it happens.
You're talking $6,000 a kid.
Firsthand.
Yeah.
Yeah. You've created an incentive for them that's so much higher than what someone else could get by starting an educational institution. They're crazy not to go out and treat kids like, hell, it's the same thing as the private, like DeVries and university, mm-hmm. The profit mills. Mm-hmm. That's public schooling.
Yeah.
Enroll, enroll, enroll. We don't give a shit what you do, but
right.
Get them in here so we can get money.
Right. So we can get those subsidized student loans that they're never going to pay, and they're just going to be written off. The trillion-dollar bubble that
we're going to inflate it away.
Yep. Right. That's exactly what's happening.
So we're running out of time. So we were going to talk about what's wrong with the Libertarian Party, and there's a lot. So we're going to have to save that for maybe next episode. So I'd love if our listeners...
Well, I thought the next episode was making a murderer.
We can do that. Yeah, that'd be good.
Because we got to get on that before it kind of...
It's not trendy anymore.
All of a sudden, he's a co-host. Did you notice this? He invited himself tonight.
Well, he was an elected school board member.
Right. Just makes sense.
It's okay. You're fine.
And we talked about it on last week's podcast that in 2 weeks, we would cover making a murderer.
Can you imagine how well he'd have done if you hadn't been sitting here making fun of little Brett Bittner and his slow learning
and his mullet?
Whatever.
Right. I mean, he probably held back on all his good stuff because you offended him.
I had such a good time. It's like being in school.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I wish you had a lot. Push Brett in that closet and call him a... Well, I'm not going to say the word I would usually say, but call him a loser.
What are you going to say, cuck?
No. Oh. No, the one that's become more the most offensive word for millennials.
Okay, yeah. Rand Paul's over. Let's talk about Rand Paul. I blame Rand Paul for Bernie Sanders, and I'll tell you why in a moment. And then we'll wrap up and end the show. But I would ask that if you are a listener to the program and if you enjoy this program, do a couple things. First, donate on PayPal. That helps us offset the costs. This costs me a lot of money to do. Because we have so many listeners, we're very popular. We have millions of listeners.
It's huge.
Huge.
We're pro-bullying.
And so,
clearly.
Yeah. We just want Brett to know he'll not escape it no matter what school system he goes to. We are going to bully him throughout life.
Uh-huh. So I am panhandling via PayPal to help offset the cost. Do you enjoy this? You get a benefit from this. Please help offset those costs and donate now.
Do you accept Bitcoin?
I don't know.
No.
No. No. Then...
No one... I have never been able to get anybody really to even do a show about it because no one really ever knew what it was.
I just need money to give to Bluehost, okay?
Yeah.
That's what I need.
The dude that came to the meeting.
Yeah, he would be a good guest.
The Bitcoin dude that talked
about
Hamilton County.
I'll connect you guys. Because I don't know enough to really talk about it. But cool. It'd be kind of like last week when we were talking about guns.
It's one of those things that, Bitcoin people know Bitcoin inside and out. And our listeners... would go find a Bitcoin podcast, of which there are several really good ones that people that...
Or just listen to Jeffrey Tucker talk about it.
Yeah, exactly right. So it's just something that hasn't... We talk about mainstream politics, which most libertarians don't. So
right.
So donate. Please rate us, review us, give us 5 stars, or don't rate us at all in the iTunes store. That helps us a lot. Share us on Facebook, spread the word, all that good stuff. And we'd love to have your comments, your questions, email us at editor@wearelibertarians, or you can email spangle@wearelibertarians.com, or Greg, it's Lenz, L-E-N-Z, @wearelibertarians.com. Or you can message the Facebook page, and we'll take your suggestions. I'm interested in hearing stories of your experience with the Libertarian Party in your area. So we are spread across the country, and I would like to hear what your interaction with your local Libertarian Party or any level of the Libertarian Party has been like.
I want to get rid of my local Libertarian Party chairman.
I need to start over with my board.
I'm just curious to see if where our listeners are at. I want to kind of take a poll, because as we move into this year, I mean, Rand Paul clearly is done. He's not going to get the nomination. It's over at this point. So Gary Johnson, I think, is the only sensible alternative if you are a Libertarian, and he'll be in the Libertarian Party. He announced this week that he's running for president. And I don't know where our listeners stand. Are they Libertarian Party members? Are they Rand Paul Republicans? Are they agnostic? Are they Democrats? So maybe we'll put up a poll, a Survey Monkey or something, just to kind of poll the audience to see where everybody's
Make
at.
Make sure you have those questions really, really easy and easily manipulated.
Not leading. So take a Survey Monkey.
If you think that you're going to be able to have enough categories for libertarians to self-identify and
other.
Not
everybody's
get
gonna
9
pick other.
Million.
What's funny is I've already done this survey. Uh-huh. I did it at the end of the summer. With a lot of supporters, we actually went through, and I started with a list of 30 options, and I think I ended up with 9 when it actually went out.
Wow.
With an other.
Right.
And I think other was the most popular option.
Always.
Of course.
And of course, I only gave them space to write like 2 words, right. And every single entry that it was in other had like 30.
Other and Noda.
Yeah.
Libertarians.
I prefer to not self-identify. I'm libertarian fluid.
See, my sense of our audience is that they are a little more Republican and conservative or Democratic, and they're major party people that identify libertarian, or they're just hardcore libertarian, but there's not a lot of anarcho-capitalists. I don't know. We just don't get a lot of that general crowd. But I think we have a lot of curious people about the Libertarian Party and libertarianism. So I'm curious to hear stories of Libertarian Party in your area, if you've contacted them. And if you haven't contacted or tried to reach out to your party, email us and tell us why. I want to know. So I just kind of want to get a sense of where our audience is at, and we'll read some of those responses in a future show. Why do I think Rand Paul is done? Because everybody else does. Just because you have hopes and dreams and wishes, and you want Ron Paul to ride in on a unicorn and magically make this happen. He is in worse shape at this point than Ron Paul was in both of 2008 and 2012 in terms of media attention, support from just general buzz. I don't see a lot of the people who were gung-ho crazy about Ron Paul on my Facebook feed or on our Facebook pages or on Twitter talking about Rand Paul in any way, shape, or form. I would say out of the huge amount of... I probably have 1,000 to 2,000 libertarian Facebook friends. I bet I have 2 or 3 people who have Rand Paul as a profile picture that I see. I mean, you may have more, I don't know, but I just don't see a lot of people talking about Rand Paul. There's not a lot of enthusiasm. I don't get solicited to go out and help Ron Paul. Whereas in 2008 and 2012, I was constantly being bombarded. As the person who hosts a libertarian podcast, in 2008 and 2012, we would have been inundated with Ron Paul people wanting us to have Ron Paul on, talk about Ron Paul, promote him. They were avid. And there is none of that for Rand Paul. And I believe that a large part of the excitement around Bernie Sanders amongst the college crowd is because Rand Paul is so uninspiring, so wishy-washy, and too much of a politician. And had he not been such a worthless squish, he would have captured what Ron Paul had, because he is more attractive than Ron Paul. He's younger, he's more... I think he's a better speaker than Ron Paul.
Yes.
I think he's funnier. He's got a better command in interviews than Ron Paul ever did. He's got more gifts in terms of communication and politics than Ron Paul does. And he has the record. Let's be honest. He really does have a good, solid record for the most part in the Senate. He has walked the walk and talked the talk, but you don't trust him. And every libertarian that I talk to that doesn't support Rand Paul, it single-handedly is, I don't trust him. I think he's a politician, and he's a squish. He feels flip-floppy. I just don't know where he's at on any issue. And I think had he actually stuck to his principles instead of trying to flip-flop and play politics all these years, he would be on fire and Bernie Sanders would not. Bernie Sanders would be a fringe, irrelevant candidate for the most part. I don't think he would be as popular on college campuses. I think Bernie Sanders is riding the Ron Paul 2008 wave, and you're going to see a massive amount of college students come out for a Bernie Sanders-like candidate in 2020, if it's not Bernie himself, although he's pretty old, so I don't know that he could run again in 4 years. Yeah, hell, he may get the nomination. He's 15 points ahead of Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire, which blows my fucking mind that he's that far.
Yeah, but that's
ahead.
Not really fair because he's from a neighboring state and he's got a personality that people are already familiar with. He's got a brand there.
Hillary and Bill both in their campaigns have excelled in New Hampshire. They have spent a shit ton of time in New Hampshire for the last 30 years. She's a known quantity in New Hampshire. I mean, it can't be that anybody in the state hasn't met Hillary Clinton at this point.
But it's one of the reasons that Barack Obama won Iowa in 2008 over Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. He had a following nearby. He was in a neighboring state in Illinois. Right. He was a known quantity. They were more familiar with him than they were with Hillary because she'd been out of the spotlight for a while. She was a New York senator who was the first lady of Arkansas, then became the first lady of the White House. She wasn't the same.
Sure.
And so they felt that they had a better connection to somebody who's from flyover country.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that you're seeing a similar thing happen with Hillary and Bernie in the Northeast.
So I just find that Rand Paul is in a small way responsible for losing the college crowd because he was the heir apparent to the Ron Paul revolution. And he did every single thing he possibly could to squander that over these last 2 or 3 years. And I can't tell you how many times we've come on this program and expressed disappointment in Rand Paul. And Creighton or myself or others or Greg have said, you know, hey, you got to play the game. You got to play the game. You got to play the game. And playing the game got Rand Paul kicked off of the loser stage tonight, practically. I mean, he was leading.
He was the... He was supposed to be on.
He was the first loser.
Well, the poll that came out was done in the same time frame. The results just weren't released.
Right.
That's why he's not on. But he's not the last of the losers. Is he going to be back on now?
Once you're off,
it's like Brett said before. Like by not being on, like even Salon.com wrote about
way
how Rand
Paul.
Yeah, I agree.
Way
with
better.
That.
Press.
I agree with that.
But like the result, Rand Paul wasn't going to win the Republican nomination unless there was another Snowden and there was another.
And he was only going to get 90 seconds of talking time if he was on the main stage debate because everybody's going to be focused on Trump in the middle.
And I agree with Chris's point. I mean, I was kind of excited about Rand because everything Ron Paul was lacking, Rand had. Mm-hmm. I went and listened to Ron Paul. I actually listened to Ron Paul speak at a homeschooling convention a couple of years ago. And I hated listening to him speak. It was, I mean, if I can't speak, he can't speak. I mean, it was bad. And I love reading his works. He's great. I know his principle and what he did. And Rand Paul was everything he wasn't. Rand Paul could speak. He could give an interview.
He can lecture.
He can lecture. I mean, he can do all that stuff. And that's the stuff.
But he can't
thought,
make you feel good when he talks to you one on one.
Exactly. Yeah. And you thought that it looked like that was the stuff that he was going to do that was going to keep that college crowd and then get everybody else.
Well, you got to remember, Rand doesn't have like Ron Paul got a college following because he was different. He was odd. He was cranky, but he was crankable, like cranky in the likable way. Like,
sure.
My God, this is the little engine that could. Like, right. I feel like half of his followers didn't know anything about libertarianism, but yeah, Ron Paul and the Fed, woo! Like, you know, basically like all the girls that try to be celebritarians with their, like, boob gate. Like, they don't know anything about anything
right.
other than they know that, you know, I'm pro-liberty because I can get 100,000 likes. Which, you know, that's where I feel like a huge swell of his support came from because I don't think, I mean, this guy was a Republican his entire life, but he has never, his loyalty is never questioned.
Sure.
Not once. Sure. Rand, I mean, videos exist of him being an avowed anarcho-capitalist in college and debating and writings at Baylor. Everything you'd want. I mean, he's well-spoken. He's articulate. The only thing...
He's reaching out to groups that Republicans traditionally don't reach out to.
Right. He's protect. I mean, he's filibustering for as long as he can. He's doing everything he can to actually live it. But he's missing the most important thing of all politics, a general likability. Like, you don't want to sit and have a beer with Rand Paul. You'd love to sit down with Ron and listen to the old crank go.
Sure. Yeah, good point.
You know, and like, and Bernie has Ron's old crank.
Yeah.
He's, but he's seen as more serious because he's a Democrat. It's naturally a disadvantage to be a Republican versus a Democrat in the American, like, zeitgeist, because Democrats aren't seen as, you know, Sarah Palin, gay-hating people. They're given the benefit of the doubt, and so the support base is already avowed hardcore liberals looking for someone to challenge Hillary. And then, oh, there's no... With Ron, it was, well, people don't even know. It's just Ron Paul. With Bernie, it's, well, he's a Democrat, and he's serious. And Hillary, oh, she's gross. Right? And so, like, that's already a bigger bigger support base than Ron could even really generate just by surely being a Democrat.
Sure.
Right.
And so, like, I think it's hard to blame Rand for not being innately likable.
Yeah.
Like, he just doesn't have that little something that the great ones do.
Yeah.
And that's why he's a senator. And like in his debates, it's something I've talked about. He never talks about what he would do as president. He just asks questions about, is this what we really want as a society? And that's the opposite of leading. Right. You have to, you know, Trump hasn't presented any particular, other than a wall, like he hasn't given any particulars, but he's talked about leading and a vision that connects with people because it connects with old white voters. And so that's generated support where even young guys like Rob Kendall, a guy who's been on here before, he is hardcore Trump, even though he's a Tea Party conservative. And Trump has, I mean, Trump's been a Democrat his entire life.
Exactly.
Until all of a sudden, you know, he realized he could get on the media more by making fun of the president in like back in like 2004. And so I think that's really, I don't know. I think Rand can't be blamed except for one thing, and that is not getting good advice on how to appear presidential. Because you don't have to necessarily be likable, like so likable, but you do, especially against Hillary Clinton. Like, let's be honest, anyone's more likable than Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
I mean, well, Bernie Sanders has none of the likability of Ron Paul or even close, but there's something about his grumpy irritableness that works.
I do want to point, though, to Rand's recent appearance on
The View.
Colbert.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Where he was a fantastic messenger of what a libertarian is, what a libertarian believes. He had some very self-deprecating humor about both himself and his dad. And it was immensely likable.
Was it Colbert? He was on Daily Show this week, right?
Yeah, he was on the Daily Show a couple nights ago.
Trevor Noah.
Yeah, and they were drinking bourbon together. But that appearance wasn't as good as when he was on Colbert. Okay. Because I'm comparing it to when he was on with David Letterman a couple of years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And it was terrible.
Right after he got elected?
He was terrible. Yeah. David Letterman was terrible. Mm-hmm. They fought, and it was ugly.
Yeah.
But you had somebody who has a greater grasp of politics than Letterman does in Colbert, and he has defined opinions, but they were able to have an awesome conversation that made Rand super likable. Unfortunately, it's too late, but I do have to say that what he's doing surrounding his exclusion from the big boy debate on Fox Business is probably more press, probably attracting more people, and is definitely a better marketing strategy than if he had participated in the undercard debate or even in the big debate, because he would have been number 8 in the way that they set them up. And so we've seen the way that the debates are working now, where they focus on 1, 2, 3 might get a couple things in, but 4 through 8 are almost completely ignored in the way that Ron Paul was ignored in 2012 and 2008 outside of his banter back and forth with Rudy Giuliani at the South Carolina debates in 2007.
Joe Ruiz runs our Twitter. We are, the letter R, libertarians. And Joe tweeted out, you know, he was trying to get a little grassroots movement going on Rand Paul's behalf, you know, saying, hey, if you're mad at Fox Business, tweet this, and I'll actually give you the numbers. That's like 2 people. You know, it's and back in the day, that would have been far more for him So let's
I mean,
see.
It was, you know, a lot of his rise in getting on the Time Cover magazine was attributable to what was going on in the world at that point. You know, Snowden, and then the drone, you know, him talking about the drones, and then, you know, the filibuster was at Ashton Carter, which really I don't think he had any issue with. But it's you know, you're a victim of these rises are pure. It's like Rudy Giuliani. Like, he, if you'd have,
opportunistic.
His, yeah, the 9/11, yeah. Him being seen as America's leader in that point, since there was a disdain for Bush and he was reasonable and, you know, likable, all these things, like, those are all things that go away. They're not, you know, either you have a great political organization, like Ted Cruz has done, when you're not very likable. You come across as, like, not authentic, but smart. But there's something hokey enough about you that, you know, the old white people in Iowa are buying it. And then there's the opposite end of the equation with, like, a Trump or a Newt back in 08 when he ran for the nomination, where you just tap into a vein of unsaid popular opinion and you can keep riding it by dominating the news cycle over and over. And you either do one of those, either have a great campaign or do that, or you're irrelevant. I mean, you know, you're a vice president pick.
You're right. I mean, Ron Paul has been Ron Paul since, what, the 70s when he, well, the 60s, you could argue.
And it wasn't as charming in the 70s and 80s.
Well, and exactly. But it was also, I guess you just made the point here, it was opportunistic. He had the Iraq War, he had the financial meltdown and everything else he could ride. And, I mean, we can all disagree, but I don't know if Rand Paul really has all those.
No,
nothing's that bad that he can ride that.
Like, and there's nothing that, like, nothing. There's nothing that feels fixable for him to really, like, what are you going to propose? A balanced budget amendment?
Right.
Well,
that's tired.
Let's start all the old white people that vote. Let's talk about what we're going to cut.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, that's a non-starter and you've already lost.
Well, one of the things I think that is also hurting Rand is he's been burned with every time he's played the game.
Yeah.
You saw what happened with Audit the Fed last week.
Libertarians,
where he pushed, and, you know, it was his payback, I guess, for supporting McConnell or whatever it was, but it got fast-tracked and denied. You've seen several attempts where he's played the game, you know, part of the endorsing Ken Cuccinelli thing, but it didn't really come back to help him.
Romney?
Romney, that's what I was saying. The first time you do something like that, libertarians are going to run.
Well, they're going to run, but he isn't getting paid back for these favors that he is.
Yeah. Well, it's not, there's no capital to gain by doing it now.
Brett, let me think this through. So he believed the Republicans when they said, come and change it from the inside, and they fucked him over. Color me shocked. Gee, if you had gone back and if he had listened to me in 2012, he wouldn't have done this shit. This program has been on the air for 4 years, and I've been saying, Republicans are full of shit. You can't change it from the inside. Get over it. That's how it is. You've learned your lesson. You're watching it with Rand Paul. He has money. He has a pedigree. He has an organization. He has grassroots. And they fucked him over for 4 years, and they're going to do it to you at your local level. Waste your time. You got to learn it yourself if you're not an intelligent person. If you're smart, you will listen to me and just give up on the Republican Party because they're a bunch of cunts.
Don't hold back, Chris. Tell us how you really feel.
Mic drop.
Yeah, that's how it is. They're cunts. Disagree with me, motherfucker.
I do disagree.
Okay, you disagree that the Republicans are cunts.
I disagree that a libertarian party, a third party, entering the national fray in our two-party setup is going to result in more liberty than any.
That's not what I'm arguing.
No, yeah, like, you know how I feel. The head of the Indiana Federation of Young Republicans told me that I was a little upset that he didn't understand what conservatism was, and I tried to quote, you know, Russell Kirk's principle, you know, the conservatism and what he said. Like, I'm talking about the Republican platform, having no idea who Russell Kirk was, and I thought, you mother. You know, I was upset. I was very upset. But he's a nice guy, and I like him. But, you know, the only chance I see that the Republican Party changing is like what happened with Lincoln, like a enormous fracture where two core issues bind together a coalition that supplants the old, like an old Whig or like the current establishment Republicans.
It's happening.
And I see that as I see the Dixiecrats in the form of Sarah Palin and the Ben Carson crowd. I see the establishment guys literally I mean, they're the old Nelson Rockefeller type, you know, Republicans. But then I do see the Liberty Caucus as getting on the news more than any other Republican establishment candidates.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's materialized into anything electorally yet. But I do think that is the natural, I think we'll see. I really do think we'll see the establishment saying, we're really not against anything the Liberty Caucus does, per se. Like, we're just not, you know, we have no appeal because the Christian conservatives aren't supporting us anymore. This is the coalition we form. And then I don't know what the hell happens to the Dixiecrats.
Here's the thing, though. What I'm seeing with a lot of the Ron Paul Republicans is that they become targets.
Yeah.
I saw it locally in the Georgia House. There was a Ron Paul Republican who really outworked a long-term incumbent establishment candidate, and they targeted him the very next cycle with a guy who was kind of bust in, didn't really have the residency, didn't really have the experience, but he wasn't the Ron Paul Republican guy. They had another guy who won a special election, same kind of a deal. Their first opportunity to pounce, they got rid of him. Justin Amash has had tremendous opposition every time he's run.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to start to see it now for Thomas Massey because he's looking above and he's starting to take fire. I saw, and the other
he's
part of that.
He's a terrible person because he's a great troll.
Well,
like, he is a master at the social media advertising, which is starting to look
so
like.
So is Amash. Yeah, they're fantastic.
Yeah. Amash's Twitter, he's pretty harsh.
The other thing that we're seeing is the people that do win and aren't targeted because they become part of the establishment. I saw one of the biggest Ron Paul guys get elected to the Georgia House. He served one term. They primaried him. He thought he was going to lose. So he, during the second year of his term, he kind of toned it down a little bit, flew under the radar. He started playing their game, started voting their way a little bit more. And now he's no different than any other Republican in the state house.
No doubt.
But for
this strategy, like the establishment isn't nearly desperate enough yet. We're talking, you know, you'd have to be 20 years of irrelevancy, like the Republicans really were back, like after the New Deal, you know, and then conservative that opened the case for, you know, William F. Buckley and Barry Goldwater and a real change in the platform of conservatism. But, you know, that's the only real possibility I see. Or, you know, one thing that really bugs me is the Liberty candidates are afraid to get dirty. Like, if I were Rand Paul, I would just stand up, be there, and be like, you hate black people. I'd be Kanye. Like, I'd be like, you hate black people. You have a long and clear record of hating black people, and everybody on this stage knows it. You know?
And it seems like he wants to do that, too.
And he won't. Right. And, like, no, what Liberty. And Ron Paul didn't really want to do that other than he'd mock Santorum for not being conservative. But that's, you know, the Republican voter, that doesn't hit home.
Right.
You stand up there and be like, nobody likes you. You're like, do what Donald does, but for liberty.
Right.
And you might actually start to see a change where the Republican says, I'm not touching that guy because, God, I'm not going to end up a meme the rest of my life because I went after this guy.
Well, what's ironic about that is you're seeing that a lot of the white supremacist groups are actually coming out in support of Trump.
Yep.
And he's not shrugging them off. It's like they don't exist, which I think is probably his best play.
Oh, yeah.
But none of the other candidates are seizing on that opportunity.
No, everybody is. I mean, and it's everyone fears him because he's a bully. And, like, you know, the one person that really stood up to him was Rand, and now Jeb's all fired up. He's a jerk. I'm going to have a town hall. I'll tell you what, Donald's a jerk. Like, ooh, Jeb. Whoa.
Well,
I know you just don't. You have a visceral dislike of Rand.
You just got to decide if you're going to be a politician or not. And this is the fundamental. He displays the fundamental problem that libertarians have. You either have to play politics or don't play politics, but you can't be half in or half out.
And that's the problem exactly. And but you're seeing that if I'm back on when you talk about the Libertarian Party.
So let me
education
explain.
Versus political.
Exactly right. The Libertarian Party wants to be an educational organization, or it wants to be a political organization that wins campaigns. And we've been an educational organization for a long time, and in my opinion, that doesn't serve us well anymore. And we spread ourselves way too thin trying to educate people when there's organizations like Brett's that have far more resources to do that and are trained to do that. and we should be training people to win local elections at the National Libertarian Party. I hate politics, but I also love it. I'm good at it, and I hate that because I remember waking up in 2012 and just not liking who I was anymore, because you have to be subversive, you have to fight people within your own party, you have to fight people in the political environment, you have to fight people that you have to fight for supporters, you're constantly butting heads with people in a public and a private way to try and, because it's a lot of relations, okay? It's a lot of relationships, and human interaction is full of conflict. And it doesn't have to be nasty conflict, but it just gets exhausting when you're constantly trying to persuade people and get people to see your point and get people to do what they need to do without them realizing that you're manipulating them into doing it. I mean, that is what it's like to be the head of a party. You are constantly massaging people to get them to where they need to be for us to be successful. And you are constantly trying to bring down your opponents and use every tool necessary to try and make that happen. So,
but I think it's possible to achieve a lot of what you're talking about without having to do the things you're talking about having to do.
I don't think so. I mean, I think I walked away from my time in politics with everyone liking me. Not everyone, but most people liking me. The people in my party, the people that were candidates that I recruited and worked with. I'm great friends with all the people that I worked closely with at the Libertarian Party. I'm great friends with a lot of people that were part of the Republican and the Democratic Party. I run into Thomas Cook, who's the new chief of staff for the mayor of I mean, I've gone up against Thomas Cook since 2008.
I didn't know you then, but you are well liked. I worked a lot of events, and I can't tell you how many people came up and asked me, "Hey, how's Chris Spangle doing? And how's Evan McMahon doing?" I mean, that's two people right off the bat. Joe Hogsett, our mayor. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody came up and asked how you were doing, or how Evan was doing, or what you guys are doing now. And I mean, you're right. You did leave likable, if that's.
Yeah, and it is very difficult to do, because you have to do a lot of things that you wake up in the morning and you go, I just don't want to do this. Whether it is calling 15, a lot of it is back channel communications. You can't call that person directly and just say, hey, could you quit being a fuckstick? You have to call the 20 people around that person and go, we need to get him to stop being a fuckstick. Can you help me?
Move him this way.
Right. And it just takes a lot of time and effort and work. And you feel bad because you just want to have a conversation straight out with that person. But sometimes people can't handle that, you know, and it is mentally exhausting. But I'm good with people and I'm good at that work. But it is tough. It is exhausting. And not a lot of people are good at it. And that is a lot of personal social interaction and understanding where people are at and where they need to be and how to get them there, with everybody being optimistic in the process. And libertarians are fucking terrible at social interactions for the most part. And it's why it was a very difficult job for Brett and I when Brett did what I did here in Georgia. I did it here in Indiana. Yeah. And it's difficult to get libertarians who are very process oriented, very socially, their social skills are not usually very well developed. So you're kind of training people how to be human beings and not robots. But as an ENFJ, those INTJs, they sure do test me. But I keep coming back for the abuse. But
and it can be a difference too. I saw Brett shaking his head. I think you enjoy that kind of work though. Am I wrong in that? I mean, for crying out loud, look at all the hats you wear and what you do. You seem like the kind of person that you enjoy doing that. And but I don't mean that in a negative way. I just mean that's your type of work.
Well, but my focus is more about leading by example and walking the walk and not having to do the subversive stuff that he's talking about. Because that's not something that I enjoy. That's not something that I really want to participate in. I want to do what my friend Nick talks about a lot, and that's show up, be nice, and win. Mm-hmm. That's Nick Sarwark, the chair of the Libertarian Party. He and I have very similar views on that, in that the people that show up are going to win. The people that show up and are nice are going to win faster. Mm-hmm. And that's always the way that I've operated. That was one of the reasons that you know, they took this crazy libertarian and asked him to run for the school board.
Right.
That's one of the reasons that I do wear all those hats, because I'm not out there burning the bridges that libertarians often do, because I don't know that there are a few people out there that you know, hey, I don't really have any ill will towards you, but I'm certainly not going to be working with you, because we don't see things eye to eye. I want to be the one who shows up. I want to be the white knight. And I want everybody that's with me to be the white knight. We have the answers, we have the solutions, and we're here to save the day.
See, that's an idealistic view, and that's another problem that libertarians have, is that to win in politics, ultimately, to get into government and to govern, I'm not saying that what I described has to be nefarious. And I'm not saying that you have to talk badly about people. Because my goal when I wake up is to end that day not having hurt another person. I mean, that is my goal, and I succeed more than I fail, generally. I really try hard to treat people well, because I want to be treated well. But you do have to play politics. You do have to have good, solid relationships with the media, with people in other parties. And I think a lot of libertarians would be surprised to know that when I was the executive director of the Libertarian Party of Indiana, I had regular conversations and dinners and meetings with Republicans and Democrats all the time, and members of the media.
You're not alone in that. It was the same for me.
Because that's what you have to do. And right. I think...
You have to build those relationships.
Right.
It's just what you talked about. I think the key, though, is being able to juggle your libertarian folks and your non-libertarian folks, and be able to operate in a way that you're a good person to everybody, and it doesn't matter, you know, when you've come on the wrong or the opposite side from somebody who's close to you or has respect for you. At the end of the day, you still need to be a good person.
And I think, and you know as well as I do, there's people. I've gone and talked to a Republican about something before, and we have people in our own party that completely balked at that, you know, mm-hmm. and protested it, hated the idea, and right. That is something that you have to overcome. And I can see Chris's point, because I want to keep that person, but I also want to continue building that other relationship I was working right. on, you know, right. for the benefits that, honestly, we have been rewarded by mm-hmm. from it. So it is tough. I agree. It's you still want to do another show on this?
Oh, God. We haven't even scratched the surface.
I know.
Chris.
Yeah, good. I just want to make sure. Okay, I'll shut up.
But. All right. Let's wrap up.
I think that's like the third time he's told us to wrap up.
Sure. Yeah. I know. I sent my wife 2 texts already. I'll be home in a minute.
All right, Chris.
I'll be home in a minute. I'm telling the Libertarian Party, which I represent, what the hell they do wrong and why they're idiots. We got to meet up, show up, yeah. assholes.
That's what we do here. Chris Mayo, we give everybody an opportunity to kind of self-promote, talk about whatever they didn't get a chance to talk to previously. Maybe we moved on a different topic, whatever. The floor is yours, sir.
I'm terrible at self-promoting. I don't even know where to begin. I'm glad you guys... let me come on your show. This has
thanks
been a lot of fun.
Thanks for coming on.
Yeah. This has been a lot of fun.
We look forward to having you on more in the future.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Apologize to all your family and friends that when you share this on Facebook, yeah. I am sorry I said cunt.
Yeah, that first 10 minutes is going to be brutal.
Yeah.
20. Be safe.
Yeah, oh, 20.
Okay. 20 is when 20 he starts laughing number. Hysterically right. at Brett.
Right.
But no, I'm great. I love what you guys do. And it's, you know, I do a lot of stuff in the party, and I can't wait till we can talk about that some more. And as Chris and everybody here knows, there's a lot of banging your head against the wall.
Yep.
And this is a lot of what I like to see, you know, just alternate methods of getting that word out and building that stuff. Like you said, and I completely agree, the Libertarian Party is not an educational resource.
Right.
Our job absolutely is to win the races that we can win, and we got to start where we can win and build from there. And then everybody else, like what you guys do and what Brett does, that's where your educational resource. And I love it. I think there's... You can't replace it.
It's about having a clear vision of the future by giving people common sense policies that move us towards liberty, and not running on a slate of I demand anarcho-capitalism tomorrow and I'm going to vote no on everything.
Sure,
like that just doesn't. That's not going to capture the voter's mind. And if you don't want to run for office and lay out policies that will directly benefit your constituency that you're running for, then don't run for office. Call mm-hmm. call Brett. Mm-hmm. Do something different. Brett, I mean, I have long said the advocate should have an LP 101 class, essentially, a libertarian 101 class, and a teaching kit, and let you guys do it, as opposed to having, you know, the Libertarian Party do Libertarian Party 101.
I agree. It's my job. I feel like my job absolutely is, for once in history, to try to get a libertarian elected here in Marion County.
And oh, that's what you think now.
We'll see where that goes.
Two more years, it'll be, my goal is not to strangle this fucking dickhead.
But I ultimately, as
especially
a person,
if you get Ed Coleman as your candidate, trust me.
That's not okay. But ultimately,
your goal is not to commit suicide every 5 minutes. Jesus.
And here we are. Uh-huh. But
campaign slogan? Cutters for Coleman. Sorry.
What was that dude that you were talking about earlier?
Who?
Was his name Pickens?
Oh, Andrew Dickens. Who's Pickin' Dickens?
Pickin' Dickens.
Saw he got the certificate.
Can't beat that. You can't beat that.
Right?
But I think my goal as a person that is a libertarian obviously is not party oriented at all. It's moving every level of government in a more libertarian direction. And that's what you guys do. That's what Brett does. And that's what I love. But, you know, my job is to get somebody elected in this county.
Yep.
And what's funny is, and ultimately, you know, organizing the Libertarian Party is the damnedest thing on the planet. God bless you folks. Like, Jesus had an easier time organizing than you folks.
What's Joe say? Herding cats with firecrackers?
Yes, yes. But, you know, I'll go back to, like we talked about, the homeschooling thing is, that spreads liberty in such an indirect, like,
it does,
you know, subversive way, in a good way, that it gets your candidate time. And, you know, just because of you, how you are with that, it lets, well, you know what, this guy's the guy Chris Mayo really likes, and, you know, we're thinking about homeschooling, let's hear what this person has to say. And it's the soft sell that is so deadly, whereas the we're going to get rid of the police.
Yeah.
Like, oh, well, goody.
Well, and that is...
Guess what? Pot's legal.
Yeah, and that is a difficult one, and that's one where I'm not the right person for the job to master it. I worked with Mike Jasper, who ran for a city county council race here in Marion County, and that's one of the things he wanted to do was to talk to the homeschoolers, because it's my wife has built up such a big organization in the area, but it was so hard for me to politicize that. I'm like, I don't know how... I didn't feel comfortable going about that, and... like taking advantage of my wife's group and saying, hey, here's this guy, you know, and maybe
libertarian is wrong, but self-government is the number one right message.
I go back to where I say the number one thing we want is to move the government in a more libertarian direction, regardless of party, and that's where homeschooling does come in. I mean, it's never going to be the majority, but there's going to be so many more free thinkers and open-minded free thinkers out there in the future that, you know, maybe you can build that one day, but...
And that wave's coming, I think. You know, as long as too many people don't feel the burn. Which I'll send them to a 4chan board today, and I guarantee you, nobody's going to be feeling that burn.
All right, Brett, how can people get a hold of you, Chris?
If you want to email me, if it's party-related, it's chair@indylp.org. My personal email, which I'd love to have, cjmayo82@yahoo.com. If you go on the... I'm sorry, I don't have a brettbittner.com email address.
No, he was laughing at the Yahoo.
I can get you one if you want.
Maybe we'll work on that. But and if you want my phone number, it's on the Libertarian Party of Marion County Facebook page.
Brett?
So I really like a lot of what Chris said. I really like a lot of
Thank you.
Not you. Not you. I would have said Spangle if I meant you.
I think I had a lot to say today that was very helpful.
Yeah, very, very helpful.
Brett's the little Confederate that could.
Oh, boy. Why do I do this?
I know. You wanted to be a part of this.
I felt like this last week, too.
Right?
Jeez. So I think one of the things that the bridge that you guys didn't connect in wow, that you guys didn't connect between what Greg and Chris Mayo were saying was it's about being that positive example, living a libertarian, self-governing lifestyle, doing everything that you can to show that you don't need to be a worshiper of the state. And then you build influence within your networks and within the people that you have influence, your circle of influence, if you're familiar with the 7 habits violation. Stephen Covey. If you're familiar with your circle of influence, sphere of influence stuff, it gives you an opportunity to be an example for them, which I think is far more powerful than anything you write. It's far more powerful than any speech you give. It's far more powerful than really any action you take. It's just by being that example for them to look at and say, hey, that's a libertarian. That's what I want to strive to be. I like the way that he or she operates. I like the way that he or she treats people. And it really does come down to, for me, treating people in the way that I would want to be treated. And so I think that that's probably the biggest takeaway, I think, for libertarianism, that and something that I really focus on in my work with the advocates and talking about walking the walk. Because we have a lot of libertarians out there that will talk and talk and talk, but you don't really see them out doing what we talk about.
Sure.
And so when you are that example, you really and you lead a libertarian lifestyle and you show that it is possible to live outside the thumb of the state in as many ways as you can. If it means homeschooling, if it means that you're involved in your community, if it means that you're just doing good things for people to make a positive impact in their life, I think that's what we're all striving to do. But we're trying to do it without involving the force and coercion of the state.
Right.
So to self-promote a little bit, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Brett Bittner, BrettBittner. You can search for me on Facebook. You want Brett Bittner, not Brett C. Bittner on Facebook. That's probably the best way to interact with me there. And check out The Advocates. We're at The Advocates on Twitter and Instagram. And just search for The Advocates for Self-Government on Facebook. And if you haven't taken the world's smallest political quiz before, please do theadvocates.org/quiz. And if you will be in New Hampshire on February the 19th, I will be speaking at the Liberty Forum. I have a couple of trips also upcoming to Phoenix, Colorado. I'll be in the Denver area, I think, and Orlando in May. So if there's some place that you want to try, you know, if one of those cities is someplace that you'll be, I'd love to meet up. Talk, grab a beer, whatever it is. Just feel free to reach out and contact me, and we'll figure something out.
Hey, before we go to Greg, did you ban Maya from the We Are Libertarians Facebook page?
I did. Forever.
She just found out. I just noticed that. I said, well, what did you do? Probably something cunzy, wasn't it?
I was racist towards a co-host, so I felt totally justified.
What'd she do?
What's the one word you can't use?
Oh, use that word, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my.
Oh, yeah.
No good.
So Jeremy's banned. Unless she can untuck, and then I'll open it up to a new male profile.
Oh. All right, Greg.
I'm sorry. If you're going to throw that word around, you can't handle some light rustling of non-existent Jimmies anymore, then you should probably, you know, not come on the page. But anyway, I was just going to briefly talk about, I told Ryan Connor I'd just talk about what's going on between Saudi Arabia and Iran and why it's a big issue and what actually is going on. And obviously it comes down to going all the way back to just the Sunni-Shia split. Sunnis sacked Karbala in Iraq, present-day Iraq, which is like the most holy site for Shia Islam. And then you had animosity for years, but the weirdest part about all of this, what's actually going on, is the situation of oil is, for the first time in a very long time in Middle Eastern history, primarily under Shia land. Even in Saudi Arabia, where the northeastern province, it's majority of Shias that would love to break away. Mm-hmm. That's where the majority of Saudi's oil comes from. So that's why you saw them put down the Arab Spring in Bahrain. That's why you saw them support, or they want to put down the in Yemen after there was a revolution by the Houthi rebels backed by Iran. They've put that down and bombed them so hard is they can't afford to allow Iran to become the dominant player in the region and control the flow of oil, or else they are really susceptible to fall to ISIS. So they're already at their northern border, northeastern border. And it's just an odd scenario where politically, Iran is opening back up to the world and more acceptable. They are seen as much more moderate, and under Shia land is the majority of oil where they can become the dominant economic player. And Saudi Arabia is freaked, and that's why they backed the overthrow of Assad, who was an Alawite Shia, and they wanted to build, you know, Qatar wants to build a pipeline through Syria. So this, that's all it is. It comes down to anaerobic plankton and the decay and oil popping up. Who controls what?
All right. I actually have something this time. I've been listening to, man, SiriusXM has a channel called POTUS Politics, and it is the best ever. If you're a politics nerd, it is the best. Oh, it's so good. Honestly, SiriusXM has a subscription for like $12 a month, and you get all these different channels like CNN, NBC, or MSNBC, Fox News, all the NPR channels, all the comedy channels, a ton of music channels, and they have something called POTUS Politics. And it is political talk done right. And it is just, it's inside baseball, and you learn all kinds of stuff. And I heard a discussion about, it was actually a congressman from South Carolina was being interviewed, and he was a former Bush administration official. I don't remember who it was. And he blamed George Bush, George W. Bush, partly for some of the disarray that's happening in the Republican Party right now. And he said, Bill Clinton has never stopped fundraising. Bill Clinton has never stopped campaigning. Bill Clinton left the White House and never let up and continues to this day to be a dominant force within the Democratic Party. He has even maintained that while Obama has been in the White House, which typically a former president will of the same party will bow out, and the Democratic Party will be an Obama regime. But the Clintons have maintained a power base within the Democratic Party.
That was the only administration, like, remnants left over.
Right.
You know, they had no choice but to hire former Clinton staffers to run the administration.
Exactly right, because there have been a lot of Republican presidents for a long time. And so this congressman was saying that George W. Bush, what will typically happen is a former administration led by the former president will stay active in party politics until the next president comes about, and they are designated as the party head. They are usually the best fundraisers. They're the ones who are the kingmakers of the party, and they will typically help shepherd the party towards an heir apparent, a successor. And now, say what you want about that. You can make up your own conclusions. I would say that I kind of respect George Bush for saying, you know what, I've had enough of this shit, I'm out.
And a 26% approval rating makes that tough,
pretty
too.
Easy. Yes, but at this point, if George Bush got off the ranch, in the state of the Republican Party today, most Republicans have forgotten of his sins and would gladly welcome George W. Bush back if he were at the convention. But this will be the third straight convention that he will not be at, especially not if, let's say, Jeb's the nominee. Then you won't see W or HW. But I thought it was an interesting perspective. I mean, I do kind of like the chaos of the Republican Party of the last few years. It's given a lot of different people a lot of different voices. It has made them a punchline for the most part. And you have seen a lot of wrangling for these last three nominations, but which also could be part of the reason that they've lost. You know, that there hasn't been a Republican presidency when they really should have won the last two and should win this time, and they're probably going to lose. So it's...
Unless it's Donald. Then he's going to win big.
Nope. Donald Trump will lose.
Oh, I think it might be nasty. Not kidding. Oh, like, just looking at the state polling.
Yeah.
Like, he's the only one that doesn't need Kasich.
Yep. So, I have thoughts on Donald Trump that we'll talk about next time, but... I'm going to be up in 6.5-7 hours, so we're going to end this charade of a broadcast. I apologize to my co-host because all three of you, I was 35 minutes late tonight to my own house.
So we were just those pervy guys hanging around the front door.
Right. Yeah, that was a blast.
We were just glad it wasn't 10 degrees out anymore.
I know.
Oh, God. Oh, God, the libertarians are outside. Don't go out there. Don't go out there.
I do have to tell Chris, I have to congratulate him on doing something by admitting that he subscribes to SiriusXM. Mm-hmm. You are the second person besides my mother who subscribes to satellite radio that I know.
I am a 65-year-old woman at heart.
That's pretty close. Yeah.
I'm one old broad in here. All right, kids, we promise, you know, I will show up on time next week to my own house. I will be more prepared. I felt I was more prepared. I felt I've been doing well lately. I feel like I'm engaged somewhat. Hey, I'm trying. I'm trying to get back into this.
We can't record next Thursday.
Oh, yeah. We got that thing.
Yeah.
We'll figure it out.
But so next week is Making a Murderer, yes?
Yeah,
yes?
At some point next Thursday. It's at some point next week. Okay. But, yeah, we'll talk about it. All right, kids, thanks for joining us here on this episode. Please hit up WeAreLibertarians.com. Share us, like us, friend us on Instagram. You know, all the social medias except Snapchat and Peach.
Give Brett Bittner a poke for being the little boy that could. Oh.
He's such a nice boy. Why did he never marry? All right, thanks for joining us here on this episode of We Are Libertarians. As always, we promise
to do better next time.